skip to the end.
Welcome to episode 55 of the Skip to the End podcast. As ever, I'm Ben.
I'm Gemma.
And I'm Mark.
And on this episode, we're going to be reviewing the remake of The Magnificent Seven. Mark, what's our topic of conversation?
Top three opening scenes in the history of cinema. Quite a biggie.
Yeah. Quite an expansive topic. Gemma, who are we movie mass debating over this time?
It's Sylvester Stallone's time, guys.
Sly himself, yes. And our rewatch topic this time, or rewatch choice, is Apocalypse Now, the Redux version, the long
yep.
version. As well as that, we'll be giving away some great prizes, taking listener questions, all the usual shenanigans that people expect from the Skip to the End podcast. Before we get going, though, there's something I wanted to talk to you about. So I was reading one of the entertainment news websites yesterday, and I saw something that said New Line Cinema had greenlit a movie of the popular app Fruit Ninja.
What?
Oh, at last. At last.
What? Said no one.
What in frig can they possibly do with that? How can that become a movie? And this isn't a rhetorical question. I'm asking you. Ideas, please. How is that a movie? Because as far as I'm aware, the whole concept of Fruit Ninja is a little ninja fella chopping up fruit with a sword.
I don't know how it's going to work, no. But I know it will make loads of money, and they'll do sequels and Angry Birds they released a film of?
I'm sure they did like Happy Meals as well and things like that.
They did do an Angry Birds film, which is also stupid, granted, but at least with Angry Birds, there were a variety of characters. So there were different birds that they can give personality to, I assume. I've not seen the film. I assume that's what they did. But with Fruit Ninja, how are they going to do that? Are they going to bring the fruit alive?
What, like a chirpy ninja... courgette or something?
I think that's a vegetable, but I... Is the ninja going to be, you know, fighting off, you know, Captain Watermelon and Billy Banana? How is this going to work?
It's really hit you hard, hasn't
it? I'm really annoyed by it, Mark.
What I don't understand, I've discussed about for months and probably years, is Tetris the film. So that was one I never got my head around. Like, what is that all going to be about?
You're not going to get, like, the Square's, like, backstory about wanting to be, like, a thin tube kind of shape fella.
Yeah. You know? I've always wanted to be a thin block before.
Oh, no, you're an L. It's ridiculous. It is an absolute atrocity. And
there's a Monopoly film coming out as well, I believe. There was a film of battleships.
Right now, and it's something like you probably get from a listener question, but before we get on and do the actual episode, if you could have a film made of one of your favourite games, what would it be? Because on right now, I'd say Buckaroo. I want Buckaroo the movie right now.
Jenga, the movie. That's what I want to see.
Operation.
That would be brilliant.
Like, get John Carpenter to do the music or something.
The thing is, it's again a sign that Hollywood has just stopped caring about original ideas. All they care about is IP, intellectual property, things that already exist, because they know it already has an inbuilt fan base, so they can monetize that. So this Hollywood studio, New Line or whatever, have said, okay, Fruit Ninja is a very popular app. I think it's the second most popular app on the iTunes store of all time, something like that. So therefore, it's going to make money as a film. Not necessarily, just because a property exists. You know, Toilet Duck, the movie, wouldn't be popular. Just because the concept of the toilet duck exists, don't make a film out of it.
I don't know, it sounds pretty good.
We're wasting too much time talking about this ridiculous idea. I want to just get on and do our thing now.
Fine, let's get started.
Right then, to kick things off, it's topic time. Now, if you listened to our last episode, you'd have heard my announcement that this topic is the top three greatest opening scenes in the history of cinema. And I'm building it up massively when I'm saying that, but it really was a big thinker for me, and there's so much to choose from. And I'm really, really intrigued to hear what you've both got. So let's just get straight into it. Ben, tell me your first one.
Go big or go home, as they say. I'm going out with the biggie. one that I think at least one of you is going to have, if not both of you, Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, what a choice. I haven't got it, but wow.
Neither of you have got it.
No, but superb choice.
I'm disgusted by the pair of you. So for those who haven't seen it, or those who have and want to be refreshed on it, what happens is we see a farmhouse in German-occupied France, and a farmer and his family are just going about their daily business, and then a high-ranking German officer, Colonel Hans Lander, played by the amazing Christoph Waltz, turns up and starts having what seems to be a fairly friendly discussion in the farmhouse with the farmer, and he's talking about the fact that he's out there capturing runaway Jewish people. And it's a very tense scene initially, because Christoph Waltz is a very odd man. He has an aura about him, a kind of an aura of threat, even when he's being pleasant, which is why he makes such a great villain. And he's talking about the fact that he's hunting down all these Jewish people. And then at some point, the camera pans down to beneath the floorboards of this house, and you see that this French farmer has been housing Jewish people under his floorboards. And then it starts to become a thing of, do we know whether or not Lander is there on a fishing mission, or does he already know that the Jewish people are under there? That's when the tension ratchets up. And it's one of those things where I actually felt like I was on the edge of my seat. Not metaphorically, I actually edged forward in my chair. And the funniest thing about the whole scene is when the tension deflates. It's when Lander says to the farmer, "Can I smoke?" And then he pulls out his pipe. And it's this gigantic alpine horn looking thing of a pipe. And he starts smoking it. I remember being in the cinema seeing this, and everyone cracked up. Everyone started laughing, because it's an innately funny thing, this huge pipe, but it's because it pricked the tension that much. Everyone was so tightly coiled, and then he brings out this stupid big pipe and starts smoking it. And then, of course, it turns out that he did know the family were there all along, and, you know, he brings in his jackbooted thugs to come and shoot them all, and then Shoshana runs off and he shouts, "Au revoir, Shoshana!" And it's just a mind-blowing scene. And you watch that and you think, how can the film get better from this?
Mm-hmm. I think that whole opening scene could be a movie in itself. Mm. Just a short mm-hmm. little yeah. five-minute yeah. film. It's absolutely incredible. And Tarantino, for me, like, he knows how to open a film anyway. But I would actually put it out there, that's the best opening he's ever done yeah. in his history of work. Like, the tension, like you said, you edge forward. That shouldn't be at the start of a film. You shouldn't be that engrossed in it. It's supposed mm-hmm. to warm you up.
Yeah.
And I'm on the edge. I'm literally like, because the very first time, I had no idea what's going on. I just knew who was in it, and it was going to be a decent war film. It's his comeback from Kill Bill, I believe, was it, before he did that?
Yes.
Yeah. And I wasn't a fan of that. So I was like, please deliver the goods. Please deliver the goods. And within 10 minutes, mm-hmm. I was totally sold. I was literally, my heart was racing. That scalpel scene later on, my Lord, like...
Yeah.
He had me straight away. It and did. Then I had a ride of 3 hours of just trying to, well, I don't know, catch my breath and every single emotion go through my body. Yeah. But as an opening, oh my mm-hmm. Lord.
It's like you said, it just grabs you. It's yeah. got you then by the jaffers for the rest of the film.
Yeah. And I think one of the beauty pieces of that whole scene is, of course, the dialogue as well. I mean, Tarantino, like you said, he knows how to open a film. Mm-hmm. But the dialogue itself as well, it's, I suppose you could almost, I mean, from recent times, I can compare that to Hell or High Water right at the end. It's not directly saying, "I know you have Jewish people under your house."
Yeah.
It's the implication of knowing that they're underneath the house.
Oh, I want to watch it. Wonder that's got to be a future movie. What a choice.
I am so surprised, because both of you, I think, have said that Inglourious Basterds is your favourite mm-hmm. Tarantino yep. film. I'm very yep. surprised neither of you picked that.
So I've gone for a bit of a fun one, but I absolutely adore the way how this opens. My first pick is Starship Troopers.
Oh yeah. Lovely.
I absolutely love this, because the opening scene of this film is almost like a satirical take on a newsreel mm-hmm. that you would see in the wartime. And it's basically opening with this propaganda style, with soldiers saying how they are playing their parts in the war against the Klandathu bugs. It's an introduction for people who are about to settle into the film as well. And I think in about a minute 30 seconds, it tells you exactly what you need to know about the film. Soldiers are there to beat the bugs, to stop these asteroids hitting to Earth as well. But the way how it's done, it is so done in such a campy, kind of kitschy way as well. The way how it's broadcast is very, very vintage. Mm. But it brings it to such a modern day as well. Even when you see guns firing off these asteroids as well. Bear in mind, this is the mid-90s when it was released?
Yeah.
It's just a really great way to start a fun sci-fi film that perhaps has not been done before as well. I haven't seen something like this been done at that time or even still now.
I think one of the things you've hit upon there is that it catches you up on the world of the film.
Yeah.
It's very efficient storytelling. They could have had several scenes at the start of that film of really heavy-handed exposition to explain to the audience where we were, where that world is, where life was for those people. But they didn't. This newsreel did all that in a very efficient, quick manner. Mm-hmm. It's very, very smart from Paul Verhoeven.
Massively. And even right at the end of that newsreel where you've got the reporter actually in the front line of the war against the Clendathy bugs as well. And all of a sudden, this unexpected horror happens. You see the news reporter getting cinched by these jaws of the bugs, being ripped open in half as well. You see some of the infantry getting blown up into pieces or just general mutilation. And then it ends with the main star, Johnny, who's played by Casper Van Dien, just screaming into the camera because he's been stabbed by one of the Clendathu's like spidery legs. And then it opens into the film.
I need to watch this film again. It's been years.
It's on my rewatch list. It's gonna happen.
Oh, I'm very much looking forward to this day.
Casper Van Dien never did much after this.
He did. I think he did Sleepy Hollow, and then he did like a load of B or C rated films. Yeah, terrible.
Oh man, I feel like the bar's been set so high. I'm like, oh, should I change my choice?
What have you got?
No, my first Yoga choice. Hoses. No, not at all. 1996, Scream.
Yeah,
it's on my list as well.
Oh,
good.
Wow.
Yeah. Good to hear. Now, this open scene, talk about like trying to grab your audience from the off. Like Casey, played by Drew Barrymore, we all have seen this film. Mm-hmm. The phone rings, what's your favourite scary movie? The whole build up in this. But she kind of toys with this guy because she likes the attention. It's a bit flirty. It's a bit like, oh, I think you've got the wrong number. And there's a bit of fun. It's going back and forth. And we see her making this popcorn and having a movie night in. I think she's on her own waiting for her boyfriend to come around and join her. And from straight away, I'm engrossed. I'm like, what's going on here? Like, is this a bit of fun? Is this, because you didn't know much about this. And I thought that this character, Drew Barrymore, because she was quite big at the time and quite in a lot of films, was going to be a big star in this film. To kill her off in the opening scene is huge.
Yeah.
Especially if she's still the main figure on the poster and the advertisement campaign. Mm-hmm. Genius marketing. So we're sat there and we hear this phone call and it's getting quite fun and she's enjoying it a bit. And, oh, what are you? And she doesn't mention the boyfriend because she's kind of a bit flirty. And then he kind of says something about the boyfriend wanting to see which door they're at when she's on the phone. And it's then that moment when she kind of shits herself. Mm-hmm. She actually sits there and goes, oh dear, this isn't fun. Hangs up and then it rings back. And it's literally building and building. And you know that fun flirt has just gone to pure fear. Mm-hmm. And you see it. And I love Drew Barrymore in this film. I think she's absolutely fantastic for this opening. But then we get to the serious shit. She switches on the light and we see that her boyfriend sat in a chair. And then it's asking her three questions about certain horror films. And if it gets it right or wrong, it depends on her boyfriend's life. Mm-hmm. The next thing we know, his throat has been slit. And it's just literally like heart is stopped. Yeah. I'm like, this is insane. And we're 10 minutes into this film. Skip a few more scenes. We know what happens. But we finally get her leaving the house and being ran at. She's on the phone to her parents. And all we hear is the phone on the floor that her parents are going to get to hear her screaming as she's being stabbed in the chest. She's wearing a cream cardigan and we see the red blood stand out so perfectly. But the way he grabs it and you see that blade go straight into the chest... It's beautiful. The director in there, Wes Craven, nailed it. And then instantly she's on the floor. She's being dragged up. The parents come into the house. The fire alarm's going off because of the smoke from the popcorn. It's all going off. The next thing we see, the mum walk to the window, scream in one of the best ways. It tops probably Macaulay Culkin's scream for the aftershave in Home Alone. This is full on. And we see her hung up in the garden. Mm-hmm. And then we get the opening credits of the scream. Just saying it now, I'm exhausted because I remember watching it in the cinema for the first time. And I wish they kind of didn't do a Scream 2, 3 and 4 because that film as a standalone horror is a classic horror, which is so difficult to do in this day and age. Mm-hmm. What an opening.
Yeah. And as well, I mean, when you mentioned about how Drew Barrymore gets chased by the ghost face killer, she runs in a very slow motion kind of way as well. It's almost like a dream or a nightmare.
Yeah.
And you think, well, surely she's going to get away. I mean, it's Drew Barrymore. She was in E.T. for crying out loud. And no, so in your head, you think, surely they can't kill her off. And they do. And it's not been seen since Janet Leigh in Psycho as well.
Exactly. It's that old thing. Mm-hmm. It's that swerve that still works.
Yeah. And I absolutely adored it. The fact that they did kill off such a big name. And for me, I thought, this is going to be the marker now for all horror films. And unfortunately, it is because there's really bad horror films at the moment. But it just completely switched it on its side as well. To do a move like that took real balls. And I think Wes Craven, I would probably say that's probably his finest moment in his career.
Massive statement. But when you think about it, like, and what I really liked about it was it didn't get out. There was no the secret didn't get out. Like, oh, by the way, Drew Barrymore dies. You know,
it's because we didn't live in an era of Twitter then.
Yeah.
And the entertainment magazines didn't have the access that they have now. So things like that, you could keep them secret.
Yeah.
You know, you think about it now. Spoiler alert here for a very old film. But you think about it now. If we lived in the world then that we live in now, when The Sixth Sense came out, do you think anyone prior to going to that film would have known or wouldn't have known that Bruce Willis was dead already?
If that was released right now, there'd be a hashtag trending saying Bruce Willis is dead the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly the
hashtag
story.
Bruce is dead. Of course they would. Of course they would. Yeah.
And it's such a shame as well. Yeah. It really is.
That's why I try and see films on the opening night at the moment, because you're just going to get it ruined for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm ready for round two. Let's hear Ben's.
Mine is from a film called Narc. Have either of you seen Narc?
No.
No.
Narc is a very good film. It stars Jason Patrick, who plays an undercover narcotics agent, and how he deals with the murder and all this kind of stuff. It's a really, really well-made film and worth a watch, especially because of the opening sequence. So at this point, Jason Patrick's character is undercover, and his cover has just been blown. So the film opens with him chasing after a drug dealer who's blown his cover. And it's a short scene. It's probably only 2 minutes long. But it's all done in handheld sort of shaky cam. So Jason Patrick is legging it through the streets. I think it's set in Detroit, something like that. He's legging it through the streets at full pelt, and the camera is following behind him, and he's jumping over fences and climbing over walls, and the cameraman is doing the same sort of stuff as well. It's not one unbroken take, but it feels like it is. Because of clever editing techniques, it feels like one unbroken take. Then Patrick starts firing his gun at this drug dealer. The drug dealer runs into a playground, grabs a kid. Patrick then takes this perfect shot, shoots the drug dealer in the head, and he drops the kid, and the kid's fine. But then he realizes that one of the stray shots he'd fired off before had hit a pregnant woman in the belly, and she's down and she miscarries. And it's so hectic and such a mind-blown scenario within the space of a couple of minutes. And the real MVP of it is the cameraman, because, as I say, it's so fast, so kinetic, and the cameraman is keeping up with this thing.
Is he literally one step behind the whole thing?
He's literally one step behind. I urge you, when you go home, it's on YouTube. You can watch the opening scene of this on YouTube. Go home and watch the opening scene, and you will think this cameraman is a god, because everything that Jason Patrick has done, the cameraman has done with a camera in his bloody hand as well, like vaulting over walls, climbing over fences.
Man.
So it's amazing. And it kind of predates the sort of shaky cam action that we're used to from now, from like Bourne films. It was really Paul Greengrass and those guys who brought that to the fore, and this predates that, and it's amazing. It's a brilliant piece of direction from Joe Carnahan.
I'm exhausted.
The thing is, like, this is when I sometimes wish this podcast was on YouTube as a video, because I just look around at Gemma as Ben's talking and her jaw is on the floor.
Yeah.
It was like Looney Tunes, like, and I'm like, I need to see this.
It's
a really good film as well. Jason Patrick, it's the best thing he's ever done. Ray Liotta's in it, who's always brilliant.
Oh.
It's a very cool film. Check it out.
I'm not just going to go and watch the intro there. I'm not going to go and do that on YouTube. I'm going to watch the whole film.
Yeah, absolutely.
It sounds stunning.
It is a really, really solid film.
And as well, props to the cameraman as well. Anyone that can do that is a sign of a very good artist. Mm-hmm. So good on him.
Steady hand the whole time. So it's back to me, I think, because I stole your choice.
You did.
So my next choice is The Dark Knight.
Yep.
Now, the reason I chose this is just because I'd waited a few years since Batman Begins to hopefully see this, and we all were waiting to see, and we did, what the Joker was going to be like. Everyone was ready to write it off. Oh my God, Heath Ledger, what a stupid decision. I'll tell a little backstory to this. So I used to work selling TVs in Richer Sounds. By the way, if you listen, I'm not plugging that company and I don't want any sort of stuff sent to me, but that was my old job I used to do. And I used to have a projector room in the back and we used to show it off to customers. So when anyone came in, I always used to have the Blu-ray, because it was the first sort of film where the black bars go and we have that IMAX scene. So I had this big 100-inch projector in the demo room. I'd bring customers in and show them the opening of The Dark Knight, because it's absolutely mind-blowing. The sound, everything, the gunshots, but this whole bank robbery scene is done so well. And the Joker set it all up, mastermind, that everyone basically is against everyone, but still trying to do the same purpose. And it's like, I got told that the Joker was going to be here in a minute. What a Joker he is. And then he shoots him in the back. And then it's like, I was supposed to tell him to shoot him. And you can see how everyone's kind of slightly catching on, but it's too late and everyone's killing everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But we get this sort of owner of the bank with this big, massive sort of rifle, who kind of thinks he's ready to take on these people. He's got no idea at all. He's sitting there while everyone's trying to rob the whole bank in these amazing iconic kind of clown masks that always stick with me, that image. And we see him just taking random shots. The next thing we see is how perfect he's done it to the second, that this bus comes through the window and he's like, it just takes him completely out. And we still don't know at this point who's behind it all. We probably know it's the Joker, but we haven't seen him. And then instantly we get this guy walk over, put a grenade in his mouth and takes off this mask. And that's the first moment we see his face. Because I think the film opens with him actually holding the mask in the street as the back image. He does, yeah. And we kind of still think, is this him? Is this not him? But he comes out with this iconic line and it's absolutely awesome. And then he gets back in the bus and drives off while all the police are coming in as if nothing's happened. Mm-hmm. And it is a bit stupid because you think, well, actually, they would notice that one bus is completely covered in dust. But that entrance of a character blew me away. Mm-hmm. And that instant moment, I was like, okay, I trust in Nolan. He got it right. Mm-hmm. And that's just from his probably 10 lines he says in that, 10 words in that opening, if that.
If that, and the way how the bus just goes into the line so perfectly.
And all the other school buses are going.
And it's like, how can you tell which one it is? It's calculated to perfection.
But every gunshot and everything, the sound is incredible. And the way that they kind of go down the zip line into the window, it's... Oh. Mm-hmm.
It is an absolutely brilliant scene. And I remember I was really happy with that because I think I'm one of the few people who didn't really love Batman Begins. I liked it, but it didn't blow me away. So I had really high hopes for this film. And then that opening scene, I was just like, yeah, we're all right. We're fine. This one's going to be fine. There's nothing to worry about here.
But it got you, didn't it? Instantly. Like, I think all the films we've mentioned so far captured you within opening 10 minutes. And that is a hell of a good sign because there's a lot of films out there that are slow burners that will you need to invest time to get to the payoff. But I think every choice we've had so far, bam, you've got me.
You're in there straight away, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Ben, is it you or is it... It is, isn't it?
Technically it is, but I think let's let Gemma have another go.
I want to hear your voice.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. So my last one is another horror film, but again, I've gone by the rule of if it gets you at the very first moment of that scene, it's got to go on the list. So for my third choice, it's Halloween.
Oh, stunning.
Now, this is just incredible, this scene. After the credits with the jack-o'-lantern just lit, we go into the scene. So we go into the suburban neighbourhood. And we see this house at night. It's shot with a point of view. So you don't know who the point of view is, but you're going on this journey with this person. So you look through the window and you can see two teenagers kind of fooling around or knocking boots, as the kids say.
the kids definitely say
all the kids say knocking boots.
And also shows my age as well. So this point of view shot then goes sort of inside the house and sees this young lad sort of leaving the house saying goodbye to whoever's upstairs. Mm-hmm. He goes off. So you're back at this point of view. So you're taken to the kitchen where a drawer opens and this hand comes out and grabs a great big bloody carving knife. Then you see this, you see sort of the point of view shot go all the way upstairs and then goes into a bedroom where a naked young lady is brushing her hair in a soft light. It was the 70s.
Yes.
And then this young lady sort of turns around and says, oh, Michael. But then all of a sudden, you are stabbing this young lady in the chest. And everywhere else, you're just stabbing and stabbing. And of course, this young lady sadly falls down to the ground. She's covered in blood. Then you, as whoever you may be, turns around, walks outside the house, and then this couple sort of wanders to you quite calmly, you know, no threatening nature about it, and says, Michael. And then the next scene turns to this mask being pulled off this seven-year-old kid, this kid in a clown costume holding this great big bloody carving knife. And it hits you the fact that this young child had just committed murder to his own bloody sister.
Christ.
His parents have just wandered across him, wandering across the yard in this fancy dress costume. Where do you go from there?
Jeez.
Where do you go from there? Seeing essentially you being this kid killing your own sibling. It's such a mind mess. It really, really is. But it continues into the film. And obviously you find out this young kid, Michael, is committed to an asylum.
Remember, Ben's not seen the film.
Nor am I going to. So feel free to spoil it.
And of course, go from there. And it's one of the most iconic horror films, I think, of all time as well.
Directed by the guy they called The Master.
John Carpenter himself.
I mean, to get an audience, I can't, you know what I'm going to say about this. It is absolutely perfection of directing, filmmaking, everything about it. And it seems weird now that we're trying to take that first person shot for granted because we see it all the time, especially stuff like Hardcore Henry. The whole film was that. But back in the day, this is sort of a 70s film, isn't it?
Yep.
It was rare. This is like, I'm not saying he's a game changer, John Carpenter, in this way, but it was iconic and everyone was like, wow. Like first person perspective of having that blade and committing it, it put you inside the kind of the mind and the body of the killer.
Exactly.
And that's not easy to do, but in a, such a way that it wasn't cheesy and it wasn't like, it didn't look fake. You kind of saw how much she kind of suffered from this blade going in. And the way it was shot, oh my Lord, like, it's got like a really weird kind of filter on that film, the colouring.
Yeah.
It's not bright, it's not like flamboyant and look at me and sparkly. It's really gritty and kind of nasty.
Yeah.
And the whole film's like that. And I think the way that we kind of, oh, the way that we see him and the way that the mask is and the overcoat sort of body suit, isn't it?
It's horrible. Sort of
it's just
suit,
it's just horrible.
And there's no emotion behind his
nothing.
Eyes.
Nothing. And it's all just, we hear is that's all we ever get. We never really hear him talk. So to know that he's gone and done this at such a young age blows my mind.
And you were there to experience every step of it.
So yeah, I one day I might pick that as a rewatch because I do want to hear what Ben thinks, and it's the only way we're ever going to get him to watch it.
Yeah, true. To be honest, the way you described that opening scene, Gemma, I'm sitting here thinking that does sound great, genuinely. Even though now it's been robbed of its surprise, it still sounds like it's going to be a great scene to watch.
But I think it's funny because even with a point of view shot as well, I think it has to be done in the right way as well. And I think by having it done that way as well, it was such an unsettling payoff for the audience as well. But ultimately, it leads into this great film that shouldn't really have had all those sequels.
Wow. Ben, invest in it one day. That's all
right.
I ask.
Well, yeah, as you say, you know, if you pick it for a rewatch, then I'll watch it.
There we go.
That's the rules
of the
game. You
might veto it. You've got one veto.
That's true. I've never used my veto.
Go on then. What have you got?
My final pick is Lord of War.
Oh,
have you guys seen this Nicolas Cage film?
I want to now.
It's brilliant. Yeah, so Nicolas Cage essentially plays a gunner. It's not too dissimilar to War Dogs. It's a similar plot to War Dogs, but much better, to the nth degree better. So Nicolas Cage plays this gunner, and in the opening scene of the film, we open up on the floor of like a war-torn African country, and the whole floor is just covered in bullets. And the camera then sort of zooms towards Nicolas Cage, and he tells this story to the camera. It's just a brief overview of how the kind of the gun industry works. And then what you cut to then is what was called the life of a bullet. So it cuts. It's again another point of view shot, and you're seeing the point of view of a bullet being made in a factory. So you watch this bullet being made, going along the conveyor belt, blah, 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 blah. Then it gets packaged up, and then you see the bullet is in the box and gets transported to an army that they look kind of like Soviet soldiers. Then they end up selling it on to a group of like African Civil War terrorist fighters, whoever they might be. Then you end up being the bullet in the barrel of a gun, and then you follow all the bullet all the way to killing a kid by hitting him in between the eyes. And this scene is about 2 minutes long, and you're always, the camera is always right behind the bullet as it goes through all the stages of its life cycle, all the way from being built through all the various different hands to the point where it murders a kid. And it's just a bravura piece of filmmaking, and how they did it, how they actually, how technically they made that work to be able to follow this bullet. It's brilliantly done. Absolutely brilliantly
amazing.
Done.
My chances are shit now.
Yes.
That's incredible.
It's so, so good. Do you know what it reminds me of? Mark, you'll appreciate this. It reminds me of the Korn video for Freak on a Leash.
Oh, when they come, the whole lights at the end is coming from every shot.
Yeah, because that's kind of like follows the bullet around, doesn't it? It's quite similar to that.
I love that when it goes through milk and all this. We're going to talk about Korn now.
So if any
I'm familiar with the video.
If any new metal fans out there haven't seen the film, but have seen the Korn video for Freak on a Leash, you'll know what I'm talking about. But it's an absolutely brilliant scene and a really, really good film as well. And I realised the other day when I came up with this, it's another film on my list of films that I like that star Jared Leto. It's a very small list. It's up to like three now.
He is starting to win you over when you think.
He's a bell end.
Your favourite performance is still Fight Club when he's getting his face pounded in.
When his face gets a hamburger, Big time.
I've literally got a list now of three films I'm going to go and watch. All of Ben's choices, which is pretty good. We've seen these as well. I thought such an iconic topic of opening scenes in history of cinema. I thought, I'm going to know them all.
Mm-hmm.
This is good.
But what I like about what we've done so far is we've actually chosen the films that we believe for our own point of view. We're not just doing like, you know, sort of
the obvious.
Cinematography was gorgeous. No, this is because we bloody liked it.
Because we're not pretentious wankers, Gemma.
No,
that's why.
That's right.
Hey,
put
I'm
down your frappe, guys.
Mm-hmm.
We'll stick with Strongbow.
Thank you.
So I'm going to end this topic. It's a 1975 film.
Ooh, what could it be?
We're on a beach, Amityville Island, in New England.
What island?
Amity. I think I said Amityville.
You did.
That's what we need to do, change it. We see a couple basically leave a beach party. They're going off into the sea. They're both taking their clothes off, having a bit of naughty time in the sea.
Are they knocking boots?
They're exactly, knocking boots. We see them go into the sea and they're kind of The girl, Chrissy, is out going out way more into the sea than her partner. And she's, come on, come and join me. Come and join me. Come and get me now.
Oh, Chrissy.
He's having none of it. But Chrissy's there splashing around. It's dark. We then see a slight kind of movement that she goes through. There's like a slight sort of pull. And you think, okay, is it the current? But it's not. It's quite late. The water doesn't seem too choppy. What is this? And then we suddenly see this left pull, this right pull, this left pull. Guys, it's Jaws. Just in case you hadn't guessed at this point.
I guessed it.
We then see the first pull down of her. And I'm sure we've talked about Jaws many a times, but to know the making of this was an actual rope was tied around her stomach.
Oh,
a
God.
Second rope was tied around her stomach.
Yeah.
And the film crew were pulling on her. She was getting rope burns around her waist that would literally nearly cause blood, but it made this film.
Oh,
that iconic scene that still, 30 years later, leaves audiences gasping, literally fear down the whole of your body watching it because you can relate to it. It's not like a ghost, it's a shark that exists in all seas. It's horrendous. But then we actually hear a scream and then the final pull under, and the way they do this is, it is a masterpiece. We've spent a lot of time talking about Jaws on this podcast. I can't leave it off. Don't get me wrong, the thing was knocking, you know, that whole dum dum.
Yes.
But this, for me, is how you open a film. And that sets the tone for the rest of the whole movie. It's a blockbuster. It scares audiences. And it was done so well that we didn't even really see the shark at this point. We just saw what it could do. And we get that iconic scene and the shot, which is one of my favourite shots of all time, of just the legs in this sort of sea dangling. And the light, it's that sort of blue tint. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is a great opening scene. I'm just thinking about that, the woman with the rope tied around her.
Yeah. Me too.
It's as if just human rights didn't exist in the 70s. Yeah. That was fine in the workplace.
Well, that's
like tying a rope around people till they burn.
Didn't mark that on her equity card, did it?
No.
So good. So, so good.
There's been quite a lot on social media. So, Gemma.
Okay. So, we're going to start on Facebook. Tom Round said, Apocalypse Now.
Interesting.
We'll leave that for the time being.
Yeah.
Lost in Translation.
For her ass.
And Velvet.
Velvet.
Blue Velvet.
Velvet. I don't know. It just says Velvet.
It's Blue Velvet.
What,
Lynch.
With the ear? The Lynch. Ear on the lawn?
David Lynch. What a film.
Great film. Andrew Ralph said Ghostbusters, The Matrix, and The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, The Matrix is, because it's been tarnished with the other shit that they released afterwards, but The Matrix opening scene is fantastic.
Yeah, it's very good.
You
yeah.
can't knock it.
Yeah. And then we had Wayne Sanders, who also agreed with you and said Jaws, Sicario.
Yeah.
Yes, Sicario.
Hell yeah.
Oh my God, Sicario. And Fight Club as well.
Yeah.
And on Twitter, we had Rob Turner, who said Die Hard, The Matrix, and Citizen Kane.
I'm going to put my hands up and admit I've never seen
Me neither. Never seen it.
I'm sorry.
Black and white, isn't it?
All those people listening, like, you do a movies podcast, you've not seen it. No, I'm sorry.
It's our podcast.
It's a future rewatch.
Yeah, there we go. Kevin Dillon, There Will Be Blood.
Oh, my God.
Very good choice. Drive, with the robbery scene, with the car scene.
Mm-hmm.
That is incredible.
Brilliant. And Jurassic Park.
I'm up for that, yeah.
Then we had Natasha Davis. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Brilliant.
Up and Scarface.
Up is not nice. That's painful.
It's harrowing.
Scarface as well. Jesus.
Nicholas Cook said, 28 weeks later.
That's horrendous. The whole wife being cut. Yeah. Oh, horrible.
Terrifying. Scream as well. And Inglourious Basterds.
Yay.
I think
she knows her stuff.
Oh, totally. Then last person, Cost. Planet of the Apes, the 1968 version.
Obviously,
not the new one.
Garbage Tim Burton film, no.
Watchmen, and then Carlito's Way.
The Watchmen opening scene is awesome.
Lord.
Shit, if I'd have thought of that, that could have been in my list, actually.
Yeah.
To The Times They Are A-Changing by Bob Dylan.
Now,
that scene is wild.
It was going to go on my list, but it didn't because that's the opening credits.
But so what?
It still counts.
It's still the first scene.
Damn you, past
like the Lord of War one I had was the opening credits
was
as well.
Really?
But yeah, it's fine.
Oh, God.
But a great
Watchmen.
Choice,
oh,
can I George
shit.
Lucas this?
I want to as well.
As a group podcast choice, we're going to have Watchmen as well.
Just yeah, let's do this. Yeah. Let's do this.
And Sicario.
Yes.
Oh, what a topic. I'm exhausted.
Great topic. That's my topic next time.
Oh, yeah.
You've got to pick something good now because...
I know, right?
It's could be your last episode next week.
You know, 6 weeks is next week. Probation review coming up.
Oh, my God.
Come on then, let's hear it.
All right, then. So this has been on my list whilst I've been on the podcast. And so obviously with all the choices that I've got written down, I always hope that no one's going to say it. Thankfully, they haven't. So I'm going to do a fun one for next one. So the next topic we're going to look at is our top three teen movies.
Oh.
I'm thinking high school. I'm thinking heists and japes and whatnot.
Teen movies.
Yeah. So next episode, top three teen movies. We've been to our local View Cinema to watch The Magnificent Seven. It's a reboot of the original from 1960, which had the likes of Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen and Charles Bronson. But we've got it updated. So before I start, I will say for those of you who have yet to see it, this is going to be a spoiler review. We're going to be saying what's happening on it, really. So
we always do.
I know. So
I didn't on Hell. I didn't last time on Hell is High Water.
Oh, no.
What was the film? Hell or High Water?
Or just Hell?
And someone tweeted saying I'd ruined it for them. Oops. So sorry about that.
Yeah.
No worries.
That's what happens when you leave me to have responsibility.
So if you haven't seen it but you do want to see it, there's going to be times posted on the website as
Correct.
Well. So go to skiptothend.co.uk and you'll be able to see when the next section is on.
Perfect.
So onto the film, The Magnificent Seven. Stars the likes of Denzel Washington. It's a bit of an all-star cast, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've got Denzel Washington, we've got Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, Vincent D'Onofrio. Oh, no, I can never say his name.
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Thank you. It's a Seth Rogen.
it's not that bad.
And loads of others. There's so many in this film, but to kind of say the plot of the film, we are in the town of Rose Creek, and it's under a very horrible control of a chap called Bartholomew Bow, a very nasty person. I didn't like him. And neither will you.
Yeah, he's the villain. That's generally what's the point of him, really.
Yeah. Imagine loving him.
I know. So, and funnily enough, the townspeople have basically had enough of him. So what they do is they seek protection from a bunch of outlaws. We've got some that are bounty hunters, gamblers, or hired guns as well, led by Chisholm, which is Denzel Washington's character. Initially, they're going to do it for the money, but as the film goes on, the gang realise that they're going to be fighting for much more than cash. That's the film.
That's pretty well done.
Mm. That is the film.
That was long. That was the whole film, I think.
Yes.
What time is it?
So let's rate it.
Join us next week. So, yes, so summary of the film, that is it. And I'm going to throw this over to Mark. First impressions.
Right then. So I went in there with very, very low expectations. I don't know why. It was a bit unfair of me. I just couldn't really be asked to go and see this film. I'm going to put it on the table there. That's honesty for you. Was it magnificent? No, it wasn't. Was it the shit I thought it was going to be? No, I'm being quite pleasantly surprised, to be fair. I wasn't fair, and I kind of want to kick myself in the arse to say, stop being so judgmental. The trailer was a little bit like a sort of comedy sort of thing, I felt. Like Chris Pratt, they used the jokes from the film in the trailer. It was a very serious film, and I'll put my hands up. It really did shock me in the way that it was a lot better than I imagined. I'm sorry, I'll pass it to Ben, but it was pleasantly surprising.
Yeah.
Right back at you, kid. Exactly the same. I went in with the lowest of the low expectations. I said to you in the car on the way there that I've not been less enthusiastic about reviewing a film for a long time. I did not want to see this. And had it not been for the fact that we were reviewing it for the podcast, I would not have seen it. It's not as if I'm a big lover of the original, or even going back to the original, which is Seven Samurai. It's not as if I love them so much I didn't want to see a remake. I just didn't care about this film. But I enjoyed it. It was genuinely a pleasant surprise. I found myself with a smile on my face for the majority of it, which is, you know, the least you can ask for from an entertainment.
That was my hand on your leg, dude.
That was it. So it was fine. I enjoyed it. Got a kick out of it. You know, I came out happy.
Mm-hmm. I liked it. I didn't think it was offensive in any way. It was very much a paint by Western numbers kind of film.
Yeah.
You know, you had damsels in distress. You had the plucky kind of like gambler who had the best lines in the film. You had people in peril. You had guns. You had bits that were blowing up, yet horses.
Yes.
I always find a very key point in Western films.
Yes, you need a horse.
But yeah, it was, you know, you know what you're going to get with a Western. I think this is probably one of those examples of a true Western film. So it was good. It's not the greatest of films, but it was good.
I thought the script was pretty sharp. I enjoyed the script, which is not a surprise, because what I didn't know going into this, who'd written this, but in the opening credits, I saw that the co-writer was Nick Pizzolatto, who wrote True Detective.
Nice. Ooh.
Yeah, and he's got a great way with dialogue, and I'm one of the few that really enjoyed season two of True Detective. I think his dialogue's great, and it translated quite well to this film. It was quite snappy. I will say some of it seemed anachronistic. So there's a bit where Chris Pratt, his character, is watching a lot of the villagers learning to shoot, and they keep missing. And he says something like, statistically speaking, they should have hit one of these things by now. I don't think people in Civil War time said, statistically speaking. That's anachronistic. That's modern day speech. So that didn't quite ring true to me. And there were a few things like that. But I thought it was snappy. I thought there were nice one-liners, especially from Pratt.
Oh, yeah.
Great interplay, great relationships. They kind of built up the relationship between the seven quite efficiently, quite quickly, which I thought was great. Yeah. I am a huge sucker for any film that uses the old trope of bringing the team together. Oh. Anything where there has to be a ragtag bunch of outlaws getting together and, oh, you know, they might not like each other at first, but then they all fight for the same team. I love that. Yeah. So the first third of this film, I had a big shit-eating grin on my face because that was great. That worked really well for me.
Yeah, and I mean, as well, it's something that we do go on when we are reviewing films, but I think it's very important, the chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
My God, the right people were cast for this as well. And I especially really enjoyed the chemistry between Ethan Hawke's and Byung-Hun Lee's character as well. Yeah, Goodnight and Billy Rocks. Loved them. Absolute joy whenever they were on the screen as well. They had a real sort of partnership, a real kinsmanship as well. But you could say that with some of the other characters as well, you know, like Jack Horn as well, the big bear with this unusually high-pitched voice as well.
D'Onofrio was great as well.
Oh, he's great. I still think in my head it's Wilson Fisk, but it's great to see him kind of play these different type of characters, because I think if you do look at his history, they are very individual to the next film.
It's because he's a character actor. He's not a Hollywood leading man. He's a character actor who can do these kind of off-the-wall different types of roles. And he's brilliant. He's brilliant actor.
Absolutely great.
What was really refreshing about this as well, there was no weak link.
There wasn't, was there?
And usually when you get a film with seven or eight characters, there is sometimes a bit of a sore thumb and you're like, oh, that guy's sticking out big time and he's just not up there. Every single performance I liked. I thought they were all very, very strong. Obviously, Denzel's going to be, just literally nailing scene after scene. But Chris Pratt, I mean, we see Chris Pratt as kind of, I've seen him in Jurassic World and I didn't really love him, but I couldn't fault him, but I didn't love him. He is going to be the big, big name. Guardians nailed, but he will probably be, this could be a slight audition for Indiana Jones if they do it with the cowboy hat and the kind of the outfit and the way he's being kind of a bit charming and this. I think that guy has got the best future ahead of him. I can see him going on to, he's nailing it now, but not just Guardians. He will go on and do huge, huge films and keep raking it in at the box office. And I just loved every scene with him in. He's up there with all of them. He's there with Denzel, just killing it.
I loved him in this, truly. I thought he was great. But don't you think he's getting a bit typecast or doing samey roles? He plays the lovable rogue in everything. He was the lovable rogue in Guardians, lovable rogue in Jurassic World, lovable rogue in this. He needs to branch out. If he's going to have any kind of longevity with his career and not just be a flash in the pan, he needs to widen his scope.
With the quirky one-liners. I mean, you're right, because obviously we know him as Andy Dwyer from Parks and Rec.
Absolutely,
and that is one of the greatest comedy characters of all time. Yeah. But you're absolutely right, though. If he scales down on the one-liners and maybe just branch out into something completely different as well, you're right. I think
he loves a waistcoat as well. He had the same outfit as Jurassic World. Yeah. That's exactly the same outfit.
He's in this film. Oh, God, I've forgotten the name of it. There's a film coming out soon. The trailer's just come out.
Passengers,
starring him and Jennifer Lawrence, where they're kind of adrift on a spaceship or something, which looks a bit more dramatically heavy than the stuff he's done.
Yes.
So I'm hoping that is going to be the chance for him to branch out a bit more.
Hey, fingers crossed. And also as well, can I just give special props to Hayley Bennett, who played Emma Cullen?
Yeah.
It's very hard to star alongside, eight or nine chaps who obviously have more screen time. But she held her own, I thought, as well. And I thought she was a great honorary member of the group as well.
Yeah. We're going to see her again in future. She's in it. She's in the Girl on the Train film that's coming out. We've seen her in a previous film.
She's the blonde lady, isn't she?
She is the blonde lady. Wow. She also played the main woman in Hardcore Henry, which is the first thing I'd ever saw her in.
No, really? Is that her?
It is. But she seems to be having a good year or two.
She has a good Hollywood face.
Mm-hmm.
What I really liked about this film as well is the directing. I thought it was fantastic. Like, we don't get many Westerns. Like, literally, I think I could probably name five in the last sort of 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
Bone Tomahawk is a very, very, very strong Western that we've been lucky to have in the last few years. But we don't get a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And to see another one so soon after Bone Tomahawk, which is doing well. I've heard that, you know, people are going to see Magnificent Seven. It's doing mm-hmm. well because mm-hmm. everyone wants to, probably remembers yeah. the original. But the directing was bloody well done. Like every action scene, yeah. I felt really like it was really well done. All the long pan shots when they're on the roofs of the buildings, the way that the tension was on their eyes and we saw yeah. their reactions on their face. It was a really well directed movie. Mm. Every shot I believed in. It wasn't like, sometimes a film could be ruined when you think it's a bit amateur. Nailed, absolutely yeah. nailed, yeah. scene for scene.
And the thing is, I'm not really a big fan of Antoine Fuqua's work, to be honest. I'm one of the few people who doesn't really care for Training Day. I was just like, yeah, it's all right. Not a great film, in my opinion. Shouldn't have won any Oscars.
It's a very overhyped film, that
yeah.
is.
And I think he's kind of traded on that. His whole career has lent on that being his one mm-hmm. big film, and he's made a lot of kind of average films since. But this, directorially, was great. It was a great choice of shots. Mm-hmm. Whoever the cinematographer was great.
Yes, definitely.
Those kind of, you know, I've mentioned this before with cinematography, but the key to a good cinematographer is when they can film or picture wide open vistas beautifully to make them look like a painting, look like a work of art. And the cinematographer for this film did that. In like the open range that we see in this film.
I have to say, whenever we saw the town of Rose Creek contrasted against the mountainous kind of views as well,
stunning.
That was wonderful
yeah.
to see.
Yeah,
it and it's
stunning.
So it's nice to appreciate the cinematography in particular films. And this was just a treat for the eyes,
there's
really.
There's a great shot where the bad guy, what's his name, Bogue?
Yeah.
He and his men are riding towards the town. I think he's got like 200 men on horseback.
Yes.
And you see them riding along the plain and the camera's tracking along with them. And that was a great,
stunning.
Great shot.
Stunning.
Let's talk about the villain for a minute, played
yeah.
by Peter Sarsgaard. What do we think to him?
I'm a bit disappointed. If there's one weak link in the armor, it was Peter Sarsgaard, I'm
really?
Afraid.
I disagree. Yeah. Tell me, Mark. I'm with you, Mark.
I liked him. I thought he was quite sort of devious and had that look of kind of... you just don't trust him instantly from the way he looks, never mind what he does throughout the film. He's just got that look at like that sort of shady, really kind of daunting look on his face. And I believed in him. I really did. I thought he was... It's good that we don't always agree. Mm. And I think he felt like a threat.
Yeah.
And I did believe that he could defeat the seven people with his army and the way he would think and the ruthlessness of him.
Yeah, no, I really like Peter Sarsgaard. I think he's very good at playing off-the-wall, weird characters. He's made a career of it. And I thought his villain was great, actually.
I think maybe because the reason why I wasn't so hot on him is because I didn't feel there was much of a presence for him. I liked when he was on his own as an actual character. So the end scene with Chisholm... as well, that face-off in the burnt-down church, I really enjoyed because it was showing his strength on his own. When he had the rest of his cronies alongside with him, I just thought, well, there could have been a lot more with that. But just my opinion, I think for me, it could have done a lot more individual presence from him.
You wanted to see more of him doing his own thing?
I did,
That's
yeah.
fair enough, because when he did his own thing, he nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah,
I really like Byung-Hun Lee as well.
Loved him.
All I've ever seen Byung-Hun Lee before, he played the T-1000 in Terminator Genesis, which he was quite good in.
He was great. I think we reviewed that.
We did
single
yeah.
him out.
And he's also in G.I. Joe, in the two G.I. Joe films. But gotcha. I thought he was really good in this. And,
loved him.
You know, and he's not a native English speaker, but his English was perfect, actually. You know, you see some actors who come over from China and Asia and so on, and they don't quite handle the language.
Mm-hmm.
But he nailed it. He was able to keep up with that, you know, that yeah. repartee with Ethan Hawke's character really well.
He had such a great gravitas about him on the screen as well. Like, I would want him on my team.
Mm. Yeah.
I would want to be mates with him. I knew that he would have my back. But I thoroughly enjoyed him. I thought he was a really great addition to the team.
And I have to say, we've not mentioned him too much extent. Ethan Hawke as this kind of...
God, I love him.
It's just kind of... He was a bit of a weak character in the
really
way that he actually...
Him.
As in weak, as in he was
yeah,
weak.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
his kind of fear of killing and not being on board with the rest of them as a confident killer.
Yeah.
And I really liked that kind of portrayal of the character. And I really liked the way that he was a bit sort of... Just had that fear about him when the others were also... fearless.
Yeah, it's like that vulnerability
That's
as well.
It.
And you don't often see a lot of vulnerability in Western films. Maybe perhaps Gary Cooper in High Noon. But that vulnerability really worked to his strength as well.
Really
and
well.
I loved his portrayal of in this film. He was great.
He was great.
As Goodnight.
It was so obvious, though, that when he left, he said, no, I can't do this. I can't kill anymore. I can't take up my gun in violence. It was obvious that he was going to come back in and, you know, ride in to help them all at the end. But
gotcha.
It was great when he did. It's still one of those, like, yeah, he's back, even though you knew it was going to happen.
Yeah. And shall we do the spoiler bit about him? Because the one thing I really loved about this film, not everyone makes it.
Only three of the seven survive.
Yeah.
Come on, then. Let's hear it.
All right. So
spoil it.
Like, spoilers. Okay, so Billy Rocks and Goodnight don't make it. Oh. And that's my favourite team. They didn't make it. And massive shock of all, Chris Pratt dies in it.
Like a hero, though.
He died the right way, didn't he? But Star-Lord dies in this. Even that chap who I can't... Vincent...
Him.
Yeah, Wilson Fisk. He goes as well. Mm. There you go, four gone.
And I like that. I love the fact that it isn't this whole unit. It's at the end, then we're all seven are kind of holding hands like, we did it. It's shit. We took defeat.
Yeah.
Some of the people made it, some didn't. And that's basically the reality of going to war with these people.
But they did it for the right reasons.
What rating was this film?
12A.
Is it a 12A?
Are you kidding me?
Because there were so many kids in the cinema with us.
Yes. They were with me. I bought them in a little bit. Really? A day out.
Yeah, I didn't think you were allowed me. I probably shouldn't mention that. It seemed odd to me that there were so many kids there because it was just wall-to-wall murders.
Yes.
It was 2 hours of murders.
Yes. And the fight scenes went on to some extent with a lot of blood and very gruesome detailed deaths.
Yeah.
Throats being slit, arrows in the head, gunshots that weren't just, you didn't see, you saw the bullet go into the head. It was very well done.
Yeah.
But one thing I do want to say, and this was only going to be for us three, but it's funny. We were sat in the cinema today, and we're about an hour in, and suddenly these three little girls walk in, must be about 7 and 8 years old. They're not old at all. They run in, and I was like, it's as if they got the wrong screen. And they ran in, like, giggling, and sat down about third row from the front, and were pissing around for only about 2 minutes, so I didn't want to get up and sort of have a go at them. They were just, you could just tell they weren't supposed to be there.
Yeah.
A couple of minutes later, one of the ticketer gentlemen that worked there walked in with his, like, he had like a little clicker as if to say, come on, I've seen you in here, you shouldn't be in here. And they got busted and kind of ran out celebrating. They annoyed me knowing that if they'd been there for the rest of the film, I would have ended up killing them.
Yeah, they were very loud.
Very hugely loud. But I kind of cheered for them inside thinking I would have done that. Yeah, like, good on you.
I just loved it when he said, right, that's it. Don't make me do it. Click, click, click.
But the thing is, they were so loud, and the whole point of sneaking into a film surely is to be stealthy and quiet. Yeah,
like
and they
ninja.
Were laughing their little tits off.
That's my highlight.
Yeah, it was funny.
It was good.
I'll be honest, I'm pretty much at the point where I can rate this film.
I think so.
I think we've discussed everything that can be discussed.
Let's do it.
As cheesy as it would have been, and as much as I didn't want it to be.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
It really is a magnificent seven. And I really didn't want to have to say that today.
Yeah.
And I was in the car thinking, go six so you don't have to say it. But if I go eight, I've literally been too kind because it isn't an eight. And it is, and I really didn't want to be the person to say it. So it's a magnificent seven from me.
I agree. It's a magnificent seven. I know.
Go on, Gemma.
Let's make it trois. Magnificent seven.
There it is. Seven's across the board.
It's prize giveaway time. If you listened to the last episode, which I hope you did, you'd have heard that we ran a competition for the new Bridget Jones's Baby. That's right, isn't it? That's the film title?
Yep,
yep, that's good.
Yep.
Gemma's seen it, loved it.
I did.
Absolutely spot on.
Hold on, sorry. Gemma, what exactly did you just say about this film? Women would like it, she said, which I think is sexist.
You might have said
and boyfriends
that.
Wouldn't. That's about right.
There was a lot of ladies in the auditorium. A lot of ladies.
Fair enough.
Sounds like my kind of thing.
Yeah, if you want to go out in the pool, get yourself a ticket to go and see it. But we were actually giving away a spa day, which I think is very different to our normal prizes. Mm. But I love it. It shows we've got variety and we cater for everyone. Now, the question I put out there was who actually played the role of Bridget Jones? I mean, that is quite an easy question.
Mm-hmm.
Gemma, give it to me.
Renee Zellweger.
And the winner is Claire Turner on Facebook. So, you know, if you're having a facial there, send us a picture or something and that would be great to see. As you know now, since Gemma's joined, I've tried to up the games of giving two prizes away. So we had a Kubo and Two Strings statue direct from Universal, which is, well, I've just said, money can't buy it. It's come from the studio that made the film. It's that limited. And I said, who directed the movie? And do you know that? I don't expect you to, so don't worry.
No, I don't.
It's Travis Knight.
And Travis?
Yes,
Travis.
Travis.
T-Knight.
And the winner is Sarah Buddery. So that's brilliant. And what I wanted to share with you both is we had an email this week from a guy called Liam Finley, who's actually studying stop animation at university.
Cool.
And he sent me one of his videos on Vimeo and told me to check out his work and said to me that this film inspired him to get into all this sort of stuff and he absolutely is obsessed. And I'm just going to like put it out there now. So I know you're hopefully listening to this, Liam. I've got you from Universal, one of these statues, because I know how much this film means to you. I went to one of my contacts and I've got you a second prize, which I'll be sending out to you because you've told me on this lengthy email about how much stop animation means to you and you want to become a stop animator, your favourite films and all the work you've put in. I thought, do you know what? This guy deserves a prize. So you will also be getting one of these limited statues.
Nice.
Yeah. So I can't wait to see your face.
Aww.
And hopefully, you know, Facebook or tweet that picture when you get it.
We're too good to him, aren't we?
I know.
We are too good to him.
This email he's done is brilliant, so I thought, this guy deserves a prize.
The thing is, though, what do they ever do for us? I'm only joking. They listen to all the episodes and we couldn't ask for more.
And he'll give us an iTunes rating, and if he doesn't, I'm having it back. So, for the competition on this episode, I think we should tie it in nicely with The Magnificent Seven. See what I've done there?
Ah, segue.
Symmetry.
Symmetry is
Symmetry, yeah, symmetry.
Is that a cross between synergy and symmetry?
Yeah, it sounds like a Muse song.
It does. A song I would never listen to.
So we're giving away, thanks to the guys from the film, a t-shirt, some playing cards, a hip flask and a shot glass.
Ooh.
And I've got two of them to give away.
Nice.
So all you've got to do is let us know who plays the role of Josh Faraday. That's pretty easy. Now, I also want to put out a prize there that, you know, I know that's two prizes, but it's still technically only one.
I see what you mean.
So what I've done, if you've been on our Facebook or our Twitter or our Instagram, you'd have seen that Paul, who does all the amazing artwork for us, did a really cool design of the Stranger Things in Skip to the End font. Have you seen it?
Yes, and it's
absolutely
gorgeous.
Awesome. I'm going to do it now. I'm going to put my own money into the pot and I'm going to get a one-off t-shirt like we did for Star Wars for the Stranger Things. There's going to be one made, okay?
That's cool.
Now, the way you're going to win this is you screenshot an iTunes rating that you leave us. And I will pick it out of a hat on the next episode. If you've already done it, then that's fine. And you will win this one-off t-shirt. How cool is that?
I think that is cool. Although I think we should tweak the rules to say if you've already done it, it doesn't count. It has to have been a review that was published after this episode came out.
But then people... Okay, yeah. That's pretty good.
Devious.
Yes. And I'll announce the winner in 2 weeks' time.
It's now time for Movie Mass Debate.
That's better.
It is.
Yeah.
Take notes
nice
there. We'll mention
there.
That in a
well
review.
Done.
Well done. Much better.
Tell the people what it is.
Okay, so basically what we do each week, we take a name out of the pot of celebrity names. And what we do is we find out what their name is. Could be anybody, could be an actor, could be an actress. It's not going to be an animal, though.
No.
Yeah, not literally anybody.
Not Flipper.
No, that wouldn't work.
Not Flipper, no.
Fred that works at Wimpy.
Wimpy. How old are you, Wimpy? When was the last time there was a Wimpy in this country?
We'll find one. There'll be one in Skegness or
Wimpy's
somewhere.
Wimpies were rubbish. They used to give you fast food on a plate. Who wants that? Give me a crappy polystyrene container that's going to choke a duck.
So definitely not Fred from Wimpy. But instead, what we do is we each pick our personal favourite performance of that actor or actress, and we explain why we believe this. So on the last episode, we picked out, or I picked out, Sylvester Stallone. So, Ben.
Hello.
Tell me your favourite Sly film.
Oh, it's so easy, this one. It's one we've discussed on the podcast in the past. By far and away, my favourite Sylvester Stallone performance is in Copland.
It's
an absolutely brilliant film that I love. It's a film that I don't think got its props. I don't think people respected it enough when it came out, which is amazing because it's got like Robert De Niro in and stuff. It's got a great cast above and beyond Stallone. It was a labour of love for Stallone. He took scale, which is, you know, industry minimum wage to do this film. He forewent his, I don't know, $15 million quote or whatever he was getting at the time because he really wanted to play this role because he knew he could do it justice. He put on a lot of weight. He plays this schlubby, overweight cop or a sheriff, I should say. So he's a sheriff of this little town in New Jersey, and it happens to be the town where all of the NYPD live. So they all work over the water in New York. They all then come and live in this village for day to day. And he was the sheriff of that village, and he's seen as a bit of a joke. He was a guy who tried to get into the NYPD but couldn't because he rescued a girl from a river and it damaged his ear, so he couldn't pass the entrance to actually get into the NYPD. So he became a sheriff. And everyone thinks he's a bit of a fool. He's just a bumbling idiot. He's overweight. But then it turns out there's corruption within these NYPD people who live in this Jersey village. And he basically brings them down, takes them down hard. And, you know, there's an element of old school Stallone action towards the back end of the film. But it's mostly just a really, really good acting performance. I have not seen him act like this outside of Rocky and Creed recently. It's the best he's ever done. He genuinely should have been nominated for an Oscar. It's not just a case of, you know, oh, someone should have given him a pat on the back for it. He was probably in the top five best performances that year, so he should have been nominated and probably should have won. It's a jaw-dropping, mind-blowing performance, and I really wish he did more like it. I really do, because it's proof, if anyone didn't believe it, proof that he is a genuinely great actor.
By far one of the most overlooked movies of all time. And it frustrates me because I'll admit it, until I did this podcast, Ben mentioned it on one of the episodes, and then I went home and watched it, and I just felt like, where was this? Why did I not know about it? And it is literally the fact that when you read the social media comments that, you know, will come up later, there's so many people that are so passionate about this movie but frustrated that it didn't get its kind of light it deserved.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Why did it slip through?
Exactly.
Why?
Because it's got a great cast. Not just Stallone, Robert De Niro, Ray Liotta's in it again, you know, a second mention for Ray. Brilliant cast, brilliantly acted across the board. A really great, gripping story. The finale, it's one of those, I'm not actually going to give away the ending here because I want people to go and watch it.
Yeah.
But the ending, what Stallone does at the end of the film, it's a fist pump moment. You're genuinely punching the air going, yes! Because you're so happy that this good guy wins. And he's not a good guy in the sense that he's the hero. He's a good guy in the sense that he's a genuinely, innately good man who just wants to do the right thing. And he delivers that performance so beautifully and so movingly that he should have just won everything for it.
You know
it's
what?
It's so good.
The past week as well, since I picked the name out from now where we're sitting and recording this episode, I tried to have a look to see if I could access Copland anywhere, and I can't. I've been dying to watch it since you started talking about it on the podcast, actually, about a year, 2 years ago, perhaps. Mm. And it's a film that has been on my list, and I'm dying to watch it.
For future reference, you know that you know me quite well. You could drop me a text and say, Mark, can I borrow it? You know, I don't mind lending you. I do trust you.
I'm going to be doing this tonight.
Yeah, but then you'll never give it back like his Jaws book.
Oh, I'm going to take it with me on holiday, and I'm going to give it back.
A masterpiece, absolutely amazing film. And what I really like about Copland is the fact that it came after Rocky, after Rambo, after lots of films. It's not like it's one of his early works that he can't ever like do again. Mm. He did it after all the performances that he's done. And like that's amazing.
Especially like the 90s kind of action, early 90s action films he did, like Cliffhanger as well.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I mean, this film I think was probably late, probably about 97, something like that, maybe a bit later. So yeah, it was after he'd done all that. And it was when really he wasn't doing a hell of a lot else. Mm-hmm. It wasn't kind of a last resort film for him. He could still get action films or B films or straight to DVDs or whatever, but he went for this where he had to take a pay cut, basically unpaid virtually, and knocked it out of the park. So good.
I don't know. Again, I feel like I don't know how to kind of match that.
Me too!
I'm going to give it a go, but I mentioned on the last episode one of my favourite films in the 70s was Rocky. Now, I still believe to this day, for me personally, it's his best performance on film because for me, it invoked every single pure emotion that I've ever got inside in one film. I loved him. I felt sorry for him. I cheered him on. I felt him get defeated. I felt him at his worst and his best. And to do that in a 2-hour film is Oscar worthy.
Mm-hmm.
He gives absolutely everything to this part. And to know that he kind of got involved in the writing and the directing and the kind of the balls he had to go out there and do this. When a lot of people wrote him off as an actor, a lot of people said that he was kind of not up to it. You know, I've read his book and he says that all he ever took was people just criticizing him before he'd even had a chance to show what he could do. Rocky is a masterpiece. It really is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to not use the word as much because I realize when I listen back, I use it too much and we joke about it, but I do. But I think it's worthy for Rocky. The way that he is throughout this film, it's such a serious role, but could be done so badly when it's a film about boxing. He could just come across as a bit stupid and comical, but he delivers a performance that you'd put up there some of the greatest performances on screen, up there with De Niro, up there with, you know, Tommy Wiseau, up there with all these amazing actors. But I just can't ever get bored of watching Rocky. And I know I mentioned it when I went to Philadelphia. It was the first thing I wanted to do when I got to America, was go to the Rocky Steps, to go and see where he used to live, to go and see Mickey's gym, because it's such an iconic film. And Rocky, for me, is one of the greatest sports movies, but it's also just the story itself, forgetting it's just about boxing, is perfection.
And the interesting thing that you pointed out there is that he wrote it, and that people have kind of written him off as maybe a bit of a meathead actor. And I think the true story behind the making of it is its own Rocky story, the fact that he decided to do this for himself.
Yeah.
Okay, if I'm only getting these meathead parts, or, you know, he's basically just playing Italian-American stereotype parts, he's like, no, I'm going to write this for myself. I'm going to create something from whole cloth for myself, go out there and do it. And he did it and nailed it. And I think he was nominated for an Oscar for the writing. I think he might be nominated for the acting as well, but I think, I think he got nominated for the writing. And it's just a, you know, that is like Rocky, you know, putting up a good show in the final fight.
And so many people don't remember that he got involved in the writing. Yeah. You know, a lot of people...
Well, he didn't get involved, he wrote it.
Yeah. But a lot of people will just forget that. They just think he got hired to go and be in this film called Rocky.
Exactly.
Like, no, he wrote it. Mm-hmm. Give him an Oscar now. Well, he did, didn't he?
Well, no, he didn't win the Oscar.
Shocking. Well, funnily enough, that we're going into that latter part of that conversation, because my choice is Creed. So it almost comes full circle with Rocky. To me, it's the whole fact that obviously we have seen him as this plucky boxer who overcame all adversity and be a success, and now in Creed we see him sort of his career's sort of dwindled down now. But the heartbreaking thing about this is he's lost Adrian. He's lost Paulie. He's no longer in fighting fit health. We see Rocky now as, I think I probably mentioned this in the tearjerker episode, but we see him as this world-weary man. He's not as invincible. He's now a mere mortal. And in the scene where we see Rocky diagnosed with cancer as well, I think personally that particular scene where he just kind of, it's almost him admitting defeat, because he's seen Adrian, you know, have the chemotherapy and for it not to work as well. And he's just, all of a sudden, he's this shell of a man. He's not prepared to fight for it anymore. He's just prepared to lie down and just let it be. Let this cancer overtake him. And it's, as a Sylvester Stallone performance as well, it's something completely different. You never see him just walk away and just accept the inevitability. It needs his mate Donnie to kind of pick him up and just keep going. It's the vulnerability that completely swipes me to one side. I just can't get over just how much emotion there is from him, because, as mentioned, you know, he is known for these meathead roles. He is known for, you know, this action hero, this guy who is the law, or this guy who can swing across a cliff from here to there and beat John Lithgow up. This is a dying man. This is a man who
should never be defeated. Fight. Rocky should never be defeated in his life by anything.
Yeah.
But this is his biggest challenger.
And I think that's why the film works so well. Because going back to my pick for a second, Copland, I think the reason why that was so powerful to me is because it was the first time I'd ever seen him vulnerable.
Yeah.
He was always just the hero who was always going to overcome. So to see him laid low and, you know, not at his best, that was a different look for Stallone, and that's what made it so powerful. And the fact that he then translated that to Creed, and it's not only seeing Stallone play that different role that he's not used to, but to see Rocky in that mold. So we're seeing both the actor and the character kind of outside of their comfort zone, outside of what we're used to seeing from them. Really dramatically powerful.
Yeah, and I would love to see more Sylvester Stallone roles like this. He really does just go for it. And it's been proven that he gets nominated for these incredible awards as well.
Yeah. And he could do more. Generally speaking, the older actors get, they kind of settle in more to those kind of roles. He can't be running around and jumping off cliffs and fighting John Lithgow forever, and John Lithgow's got other things to do.
And so he's knocking around.
He's knocking, you know, he's getting on. So he hopefully will start taking more scripts like that, where he gets to show a bit more of his emotional side and his dramatic range.
And I don't want any more expendable films. I'm sick of them.
I've never seen any of them.
Don't bother.
Neither have I. No.
What I really like about this, and we'll go through the social media stuff now, but when we launched this, a lot of people were quite annoyed with the fact that we knocked, you know, Skip back in time on the head. But just going through the social media stuff, I love the fact how much people put into their reason. It's not just saying the film.
Yeah.
So literally, Ian Dickie put Creed because it made him cry. Mm. He's putting his, you know, it made him cry. Gerald Carney put Rocky Balboa.
Rocky, you?
Rocky, you know, the surname.
Balboa.
Film. Balboa.
No, try again.
Rocky Balboa. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The scene when he explains to Paulie why he can't fight again is just pure class. You can't argue. Tynan Welsh said Copland because incredibly throughout his performance literally stands on edge, but the most overlooked performance of all time. You know, and like we said today, those exact words.
I think we did a topic way back in the midst of time that were most overlooked performances in films, and that was one of my picks
back then. That's what made me go and literally buy it.
Yeah.
And now this topic will make you go and buy it.
It will do.
Chris Smolensky has said Over the Top.
That's the arm wrestling film. Yes.
That film's ridiculous, but fun.
Scott Whiteley has put First Blood. Why? Because he breaks your heart as a man trying to find a place in the world only to be pushed away for it.
Oh my God, that's so heart-wrenching.
I never understood why the second Rambo was called Rambo First Blood Part 2. Call it Second Blood.
Yeah. Chris Duck has put First Blood purely for the monologue in the actual final act. Pure class, again. And finally, Alex Dorman has put Copland, a character with all the vulnerability of John Rambo in First Blood, but less of the machismo.
Machismo?
I would say machismo, but
machismo. Oh. But again, I just love the reasons. I absolutely love this topic, and it has actually become my favourite part of the podcast. So
it's great, isn't it?
It is.
It's going to run and
feature.
Run.
It's a good feature.
I am so intrigued. So Mark now has the pot of plenty in his hand. He's about to pick out the next name.
Sure, guys. To make it a bit more of a suspense, can we have a bit of a drum roll as I read out who we got? God, it sounds really good. Wow. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Ready.
It's a female.
Oh.
On the next episode, and I've done this before, we will be masturbating over Winona Ryder.
Nice!
Yes.
I look forward to that very much. Our rewatch this week is Apocalypse Now, a film that I had never seen. Mark, I can't remember, had you seen it or not?
I'm going to put my hands up and say I watched it at uni, but I was absolutely off my face. I'm not even going to lie. And I think I passed out because it's 3 hours long and about an hour and a half in. But I remember bits, but it was one of those things. Did I dream it? Was I wasted? I don't know.
Yeah, Gemma, had you seen it before?
This was the very first time I'd ever seen it.
So you were going in bone dry.
Same absolutely. Yeah.
So this film tells the story of a special ops soldier called Captain Willard, played by Martin Sheen. He has been tasked by the army of travelling through Vietnam to track down a rogue colonel, Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando. Kurtz has gone off script completely and he's waging the war his own way. He's effectively set himself up as a demigod in Cambodia and has a private army doing his bidding. The first, probably two-thirds of the film, follows Willard as he's making his way through Vietnam on a riverboat through the jungles. And the final third of the film is when he actually gets to Kurtz's compound. And all the things that happen there. We're going to discuss all the elements of it. Again, it's going to be spoilerific. These things always are. Now, we didn't just watch Apocalypse Now. We watched the Apocalypse Now Redux, which was Coppola's, I think, when did it come out? Was it in the 90s he put it out? The early 2000s.
Like that,
He decided to put back in a lot of the footage that, for whatever reason, didn't make the original theatrical cut. Some of those were aesthetic reasons. He didn't think they worked. Some of the reasons were the studio said, no, we're not having it. You need to cut it down. So he put out this full version, which is a close to 3.5 hour long film. It was a long film. But was it a good film? Mark, having seen it once when you were wasted and can't remember the end, did any of it come back to you? What did you think?
I didn't have any of it come back to me, so it just showed how wasted I was. Mm. I'm going to just cut to the chase. This is now my favourite war film ever made.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to start elaborating and saying why. Gemma, let's hear your thoughts and then we'll have a full-on discussion.
Yeah.
Well, it's a work of art, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's an absolute work of art. How I've never seen this film is absolutely beyond me, but this is absolute perfection. And I completely see the reasons as to why Coppola nearly put himself in an early grave for it as well.
Yeah.
the time, the blood, the sweat, the tears, the hardship was completely worth it. And this needs to be preserved for future generations to rewatch again and again.
Yeah, very well said from both of you. I couldn't agree more. I concur entirely. It's a phenomenal film. Again, like you said, Gemma, how I've not seen this before is insane. And it is a film that I am going to watch again and again.
Hell yeah.
And again, because it's a gut punch of a film. It's an absolute masterpiece. Mm-hmm. Mark, I'm using your
word. You know what? I tried to not use that word.
It is, though. If ever it was an appropriate usage of the word, it's right there.
Yeah.
I'm going to just put it out there now to us, all three of us. Mm. Do you feel a little bit annoyed with yourself that it's took till now to really watch this? We are a movies podcast that let's blow our own trumpet a little bit, that are doing pretty well for ourselves. People know who skipped the end are now. It disgusts me, and I feel a bit of a fraud that we're on 55 episodes and we haven't watched this absolute incredible perfection of a film. And we've been taught, I feel like I can't really have an opinion, and now I can start having an opinion. It feels wrong.
And it's not just that we've got to 55 episodes, it's the fact that we've all got to our mid-30s and
some
haven't seen this. You know.
And like a lot of people said on Twitter when I put it out there on Facebook, guys, do not watch this. Wait, just watch the cinema release, 2.5 hours. Yeah. Or you should have done it the other way around. I can't comment now because I've not seen the theatrical cut. So I'm sitting here kind of like, maybe it's even better with stuff chopped out. But there was not one bit for me that I felt was like, oh, this shouldn't be in. Or I felt it was perfect at 3 hours 14.
I have since gone, and I haven't seen the theatrical cut, but I have read a breakdown of what is different in the reading.
Cool.
So I know exactly what wasn't there in the original. And there are some bits that I'm going to talk about later on as we get through it. But let's start from the start then. It's one of the most beautifully directed, shot and framed films I have ever seen. And that's thanks to two people, obviously. That's thanks to Francis Ford Coppola, who directed it, and thanks to Vittorio Storaro, who won an Oscar for the cinematography. I don't think I've ever seen a film that looks like this. There are many beautifully shot war films out there, but this one is... I'm kind of in awe of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's hard to put into words. The use of colour, I think, is magnificent. So a lot of these scenes have a very kind of dark red, deep red filter on them, especially a lot of the battle scenes. And then you have the scenes that take place in the depths of the jungle and have really deep green filters on them as well. This use of colour that's so vivid and just jumps out of you. It's beautiful to watch.
The way they actually make Vietnam look, the way that the... It sounds really ridiculous, but the skin tone and everything, the crispness of everything.
Yeah. Right.
This film was made in 1979, so automatically I'm putting this... If we ever do the top 370s films again, I'm sorry, this is going in. This film, shot for shot on my Blu-ray, looked as if it was filmed yesterday.
Yeah.
And that is scary, considering it's nearly 40 years old. That is absolutely scary as hell. I don't really appreciate... until now, how good of a filmmaker he is. Because until now, I just associate Godfather every time.
Yeah.
Godfather, 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 which is a beautiful film, which is shot really well. But to go off and do a war film so soon after The Godfather and nail it, every shot was perfect. Mm-hmm. Every bit of directing was perfect. And I need to start giving this film director more of my attention and time because I feel like I've ignored it and I've been a bit ignorant.
Stick to his earlier work. Like stuff like Tetro and Youth Without Youth that he's done recently is shite. But something that Gemma and I know, because we've both seen the documentary about the making of the film, Hearts of Darkness, is that he was damn near on the verge of insanity himself when he made the film. He was going on his own personal Kurtz-like journey.
You know what? That's a really good analogy because he almost became Kurtz.
Yeah.
Like, his wife was secretly recording some of the conversations that they were having. And he was saying things like, you know, I might as well just put a gun to my head.
Yeah.
Or this is going to kill me. You know, he put his house and his possessions up as collateral for the movie.
He paid for a lot of it.
He was going to be bankrupt if this film wasn't going to be a success. And I think it overran by, 4 years, 5 years?
The film was... it wasn't quite that long. But it was supposed to be a 16-week shoot and it ended up being 283 days. 283 23 days, which is
Christ.
Immense, like a damn near year shoot. And there were points in this documentary where you hear him saying things like, this film's awful, it's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
I keep telling people and they keep saying to me, no, that's what you always say. And he's like, yeah, but this time I mean it. It's awful. It's not working. And then it came out to be this masterpiece that was nominated for all the Oscars. Everyone knows it's one of the greatest films ever made.
God, yeah.
But he just didn't believe it when he was doing it because it had taken so much out of him.
And the one thing I would love to do, if I could ever go back in time and this was released, I would love to show him the first 5 minutes of this film. Now, the opening scene of this, it didn't make the top three early because I wanted to basically just talk about it on the rewatch.
Yeah.
The opening scene is something of absolute sheer beauty, with the doors in the background playing the end, and you see this jungle just blowed up into smithereens by a napalm attack as well. And then we get this beautiful intercut of Martin Sheen lying on a bed, looking absolutely dazed and completely strung out. And it wasn't until you watch the documentary of Heart of Darkness, that scene where you see him sort of dance around in his underwear in front of the mirror and then punch it, he was absolutely wasted off his face.
Yeah, shit-faced drunk.
He was battling an alcohol addiction at the time. And Coppola just wanted to roll the cameras and just watch him. They didn't really give him any direction, did they?
No.
And to the point where the crew were so scared that Sheen was going to lunge out at Coppola and start attacking him. And he just has this very bizarre, weird breakdown, doesn't he? Mm. He didn't even realise he punched the mirror.
Yeah.
He didn't realise he was bleeding.
That's all real, because he thought the mirror was farther away. Yeah. He was just kind of shadow punching, but it was so close to him, he punched it and sliced open his thumb. So that scene you see of him on the bed and the bed sheets covered with blood, that's legit. Mm-hmm. That is Martin Sheen bleeding for his art there.
And even when you see him absolutely howling, like this primal kind of cry out of his mouth.
Yeah.
You don't hear it on the introduction, but boy, can you? You could probably hear it just even watching it. Yeah. It's, and I think that's a testament to Sheen's acting prowess throughout this film. Mm-hmm. He is a wonderful lead man as well.
He's superb, yeah.
Absolutely wonderful.
I don't think I realised how good his performance was.
Mm.
People talked about it. I was like, yeah, I'm sure it's pretty good. And then I watched it. And I don't know if I kind of, I'm a bit disappointed knowing he's absolutely wrecked off his face. Because I thought he gave the performance of his life, but he was just absolutely wasted.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's tainted it a bit for me now, hearing that. I don't know, it's a strange one, because I suppose it's the director's decided to capture it going on, but I thought he gave that performance.
Yeah, but that could be like the torture of particular artists or singers or actors. They use that inner turmoil to bring out the best of them.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That wasn't just, it wasn't just Martin Sheen acting drunk. It was Martin Sheen drunkenly playing the character of Captain Willard. Yeah. So it was still acting. Yeah. It was just using substances to get there.
But that's how we got Quint's performance.
Yeah,
he was always
that wasn't like a consciousness. He was just a pisshead, wasn't he?
Marlon Brando.
The funny thing is, Kurtz, Marlon Brando, doesn't even turn up until 2 hours and 38 minutes of the film.
And then you get a bit of audio at the first 10, 15 minutes, don't you? Just basically him rambling, just how he's going insane.
Again, as someone I need to just go back and watch more work, because even though it took 2.5 hours to get there, when I got him, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know, I will put my hands up, I'm sounding like an amateur. What are you doing a podcast, Mark? You have no right. I didn't even know Harrison Ford was in this movie.
No, I didn't either, to be honest.
We'll come back to Thor, but let's stick with Brando for a bit.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, even though you don't see him till 2 hours, 38 minutes, the threat of him, the myth, the idea of him hangs over the film, because there's a lot of voiceover leading up to when we meet him, and it's Martin Sheen's character talking about, you know, his army career, what Kurtz had been through, how he got to this point. And he's built up to this mythical-like proportion, which makes sense, because when he gets to Kurtz's compound, Kurtz has set himself up as a demigod.
Yeah.
So all the build-up, it lives up to it. The eventuality matches the build. So when you finally get there, you're like, Christ, he has actually got worshippers, not just soldiers, worshippers who are following him blindly now. And it's breathtaking. Something, going back to what you said there, Mark, about how it might take a little bit away from Martin Sheen knowing that he was drunk. I've got a similar thing, which comes from watching Hearts of Darkness. There's not really that much dialogue from Brando as Kurtz. He has two or three scenes in the back end of the film when he's kind of spewing this kind of semi-profound stuff about the futility of war and this kind of stuff. I presume that was all scripted. So believing that it had been written, I thought, okay, this has been crafted and put together in a certain way. It turns out from watching Hearts of Darkness that because Brando was a pain in the arse, he turned up massively overweight. He couldn't pull off the certain action beats they wanted him to do, so the script no longer made sense. He wouldn't give Coppola the time to rewrite the script. So basically they said, okay, we're just going to have to wing it. So they got Brando to pretty much ad-lib all of his dialogue. So that stuff he's saying when he's like covered in shadow, yeah, all these profound things he's saying, he's making that shit up on the spot. And they show in this documentary bits that they cut out of babble. And apparently like he did 18-minute long takes of him just spouting this stuff. And now it's like, it's pleasing, it's nice to hear, it sounds good, but it's nonsense. When I thought it was scripted, I thought it had some weight to it, but now it just feels like kind of pretty nonsense to me now.
Even on the documentary, he turns to Coppola and just says, I've had enough. I've done all I can today. Yeah. If you want anything else, go get another actor.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a quick question? How long is this documentary? Because
it's only an hour and a half.
Hour and a half. It's watch it. Fantastic. Yeah.
It's part of the Blu-ray set, and I've just run out of time. But I kind of, in a weird way, for the listeners' view, it's quite nice that I'm hearing this for the first time because it's shocking, some of this stuff. But I'm also, when you're saying there that he's ad-libbed a lot of this, that also now makes me respect him a bit more, because I think if you can do that, I know you said there's a lot of cuts of just dribble, but what he did do, he nailed.
I just feel like I wish it had been scripted by the screenwriter rather than just shit he came up with on the day because they had no other choice. Another thing about him turning up overweight is that you were going to see him a lot more. You only really ever see him in shadow. His face is usually half shaded. You never really see the length of his body other than in shadow, and that was purely a decision based on the fact that he turned up overweight. That wasn't going to be the way it was. This, what appears to be a great artistic decision of him being shadowed, was not artistic at all. It was a practical decision to hide his fat belly.
But you could argue and say when, spoiler alert, by the way, guys, when he does get slain by Willard, and then Willard sort of almost in a way starts going into the shadows himself because we see the villagers look at him as possibly their new god as well.
Yeah.
And they start bowing to him. And it's almost like he's taking the place of Kurtz. And I thought that was a kind of a cool artistic kind of decision. But then, of course, you see him walk away. He's not down for that.
No, he's getting in the boat and
he ain't got time for that shit.
Yeah.
I must say, though, his narration for his throughout the film, which I didn't realise how much of it was narrated by himself. You don't realise it's like throughout the film, there's probably about an hour of him speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but I could listen to that guy talk forever.
Mm.
Like, he alone gets your attention to the what's going on. But then you are spoilt, really, because you get that amazing cinematography and directing anyway. Yeah. But his voice gets me focused on what's going on anyway. And it's like I'm listening to an audiobook with him. He's so good. And then I'm seeing him on screen delivering some of this Oscar-winning performances, in my opinion, like the best summer acting I've ever seen. To get that together, I think is a perfect.
And the thing is, voiceovers are a tricky proposition because sometimes they can be used as a crutch. They're used to fill in the blanks when a filmmaker can't fill the blank in any other way. And often voiceovers fall down because they're just stating the obvious. It'll be someone saying exactly what's on the screen, so it serves no purpose. This wasn't that.
No.
This was giving you the backstory of Kurtz, building up this myth, as I've said, and also getting you into the mindset of Willard, of how he was, where his head was at. The voiceover added more to the film. Often the voiceover will detract from a film, like some of the god-awful cuts of Blade Runner that had an enforced voiceover on that just didn't work. This really added to it, added a depth to it. The film wouldn't have been as good without it.
No, exactly that. Mm-hmm. And just, you nailed it there. Absolutely nailed it. It doesn't work for some films, and it gets it wrong. For the amount you get and the duration of him, wow. Perfect, perfect match.
Gotcha, yeah.
We mentioned briefly Harrison Ford. Because this film took nearly a year to film, at the time when they started filming, it was like sort of 76, I think they were putting this together, 76, 77. So at the time, he was filming Star Wars, but Star Wars hadn't come out yet. So that's why Ford is only in like one scene for about 30 seconds, because they didn't realise at the point of filming they had a superstar in the room. They didn't know they had Han effing Solo, who's going to just destroy the world right there in the room. So that's why he's got this tiny little role. But I didn't even know he was in it until I saw it.
He shouldn't even deserve a credit, really. It's such a small part. It should just be a little featuring cameo from Han Solo.
I'll tell you who was great, though, talking of small parts, was Robert Duvall Lieutenant Kilgore. How great was he?
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
The fact he gets that line,
and
it's one of the most quoted lines, and like you said, it's such a small part.
Yeah.
And I found everything with him in darkly comic. I don't know if you found it funny, because the whole point of Kilgore is that he couldn't give two shits about the war. All he cared about was surfing. And when he found out that one of the people travelling with Willard was a professional surfer, all he wanted to do was find a spot in Vietnam to
and
surf
go with him.
Whilst it was still going on.
Whilst it was still under, the war was going on. This particular point, he was like, it's still under Charlie control. He's like, doesn't matter, Charlie, don't surf. So they landed there. He got his people to napalm a whole stretch of, like a whole village, just to clear out the area. He was like, look at the waves, it's breaking one way, it's breaking the other way. Get my board. I love my board. People are dying around you.
And you know what? Speaking of the napalm attack, how can we not talk about the ride of the Valkyrie scene?
Oh, man.
Possibly one of the greatest scenes, I think, visually, acting-wise, that the sound effects as well, the use of music, everything is just pure synergy with this scene.
The thing is, with the actual war action scenes, I think Saving Private Ryan was one of my favourites as now until now. I think the way they did that, especially that's a really good opening scene. Thinking about it,
amazing, amazing.
Yeah, I think to be fair to Spielberg, he directed a perfect looking war film. Considering this guy did it 25 years before,
yes.
I don't think I've seen an invasion scene as well as this. And I know we joke and say stuff like Michael Bay does, you know, Pearl Harbor and stuff, but he's got all the technology and all the best cameras in the world and a stupid budget with way too many people working for him, helping him. Yeah. This guy, by the sounds of it, had the worst time of his life at times making this film. But the way he actually made the attacks look and the people running being shot and the... everything about it, the fear that it put through you of an actual invasion in war, was by far the best portrayal I've seen of war on screen.
Yeah.
It's magnificent. You felt like you were in those helicopters or on the ground being shot by those helicopters. Yeah. One of the other things that you learn in the documentary is that he couldn't get the American military to loan him any stuff. He wanted to get the American military to loan him weapons and helicopters and so on. And they said, no, because your plot is about killing a soldier, so we're not going to let you do that. So he had to go to the Philippines government, because it was filmed in the Philippines. And he got the army of the Philippines to loan him a load of helicopters. The problem was, they had to be used to fight insurgent rebels in southern Philippines. So he'd have them for a day. They'd be all set up, they'd rehearsed a scene, and then they'd get a call through on the walkie-talkie saying, oh, we've got to go and fight some rebels. And the helicopters would fuck off for the day. And this is one of the many reasons why the film took a lot longer to film than it should have.
It's crazy.
I need to watch this documentary.
You do. It's just mind-blowing. I think if I didn't see this, I think this would have made the top three documentary list for me.
I want to talk briefly about the differences between the original version and the Redux version. The major scene of difference is towards the back end of the film. The guys are travelling up the river, so Willard and his team are on their boat, and they're travelling up the river, and they finally get to the final American outpost in Vietnam. And then after that, he says, beyond there is Kurtz. So you think they're going to cross into Cambodia and find Kurtz. But before they do that, they end up at a French colonial rubber plantation.
Yeah, like a plantation, yeah.
And there's this long scene, it's about half an hour maybe, 25 minutes, where they go into this plantation, and he's sitting with these French people, and he's saying, why are you still here? You're going to get killed. I'm like, this is our home, we are here. Yeah. And the whole scene, the whole reason why it was in the film in the first place was because Coppola wanted to contrast the idea of European colonialism with American interventionism. He wanted to show that those two things are very, very similar. But it's a very long and boring scene in this French house. And then Martin Sheen's character ends up shagging the daughter.
Yeah.
And it's pointless. And it really, really slows the momentum. It should have gone from them getting past the last army outpost to finding Kurtz. But we have this long, slow deviation. It was cut out of the original, not because it was slow and boring, but because... Coppola didn't think enough money had been invested in it. He didn't like the way the shots looked. He didn't like the lighting.
The lighting was terrible.
So he'd spent hundreds of thousands on this and decided, I don't want it, get rid of it. Yeah. His words were, let's pretend we never filmed
it. That was right, yeah, that's on the documentary.
So he got rid of it. And this is one of the reasons why people say the theatrical cut is better, because it doesn't have that shit with the French colonialists. It just goes from A to B, and it flows better. He then put it back in the Redux because he had the money to use post-production techniques to make it look snazzy as he wanted it to, put it back in, but I wish he hadn't.
Yeah.
It's the one scene that just absolutely doesn't work for me at all.
Yeah,
it's too long, it serves no purpose, it's boring.
I agree. Just get to the demigod.
Mm-hmm.
What I will do now is I will go and watch now the 2.5 hour intended cinema release, because now I wouldn't have wanted to have seen that then, the Redux. I'm glad I've kind of seen the whole thing and then I can spot. I would have really been annoyed with myself if I'd seen the cinema cut and then been spoiled with the Redux.
I think we did the right thing by doing this.
Well, yeah, I'll watch the documentary and then I'll watch the cinema cut. And I think Ben, at the start of this whole section, said it's a film he'll watch again and again now.
Yeah.
I can see me watching this every sort of 6 months, a year, and I'll be seeing stuff I didn't see, I'll see stuff I didn't know. This will be, if I ever see this on at a cinema, you know, for like the Prince Charles this, I will be there.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Lord, yeah.
You know, I need to see this on the big screen.
That'd be immense,
Yeah, it's just simply one of the greatest films ever made.
Yeah.
Shall we rate that and see what we're going to do?
Let's do it.
I remember, you know, given a film such a high score would have to be something that's usually close to me and been there from the start, and I can talk about how it's been, I think, you know, stood the test of time and meant something. That goes all out the window for me on this because it's a first time viewing, but I'm going to do it. This gets a perfect 10 from me.
Wow.
Which is massive. And I know that's a huge statement, but it's a flawless film. We've just sat here and there's not one thing we could fault apart from a scene that you would take out, which is not even in the cinema cut anyway. Mm. So for me, directing, acting, cinematography, the soundtrack, the score, the acting, everything is perfect. So how can I not give it a 10? And I will probably love it even more and more as time goes on.
For me, it's an 8. I couldn't give it a 10 because I don't think I can ever give a film a 10 the first time I see it. I think I need to have seen it a few times for it to really dig its claws into me before I could give it a 10. And also because of the flabbiness of the Redux, specifically that French scene, 25 minutes of wasted time for me. Had I seen the original cut first, I think I probably would have given it a 9. But because of that scene, I'm going to knock it down a peg. So I'm going to give it an 8. Whereas I truly think if I go and watch the theatrical cut next week, it would then be a 10 because I'll have seen it twice without the boring bit. Yeah. But for now, it's an 8.
I think that's unfair because a cow lost its life for
you. Oh, sorry. You know what? I'm so glad we went through without talking about that cow.
Give me your rating.
Brutal.
Okay, for me, it is a 10.
Whoa.
I think it's just the fact that it's been a very, very long time where I genuinely cannot remember the last time where I watched a film for the very first time and not be completely in awe and in admiration of it. And this film has completely ticked all of those boxes. It is perfection and it is a 10.
I think it's still a 9.
Should we call it a 9?
Yeah.
Which is pretty fair.
Which is pretty good. I mean, it's for a rewatch for a film that two of us hadn't seen and one of us saw once under the influence
of alcohol.
Of course.
Many drugs.
I think for it to end up as a 9 is pretty bloody good, actually.
Yeah.
9 out of 10.
So it's my rewatch choice. And I'll be honest, I feel like this whole episode has been setting a bar so high, I don't know what I'm going to do. So with the topic choices, your explanations were so good, I thought, shit. I'm going to say it now. This film choice is not going to be better than what we've just talked about. How is it going to be?
Yeah.
But it's a film for me that is a film I would like more people to know about, especially the people that listen to us from America and across the pond. We've got a lot of listeners out there that I don't think have heard about this British film.
Oh, okay. Brilliant.
So for me, it's a very personal choice, but I know that you'll both be very happy with it. The director and writer is known a lot more for the TV work previous to this. So on the next episode, we will be watching Four Lions.
Wow.
Chris Morris.
Do you know what? I'm so happy you've said that because I'm one of the biggest fans of Chris Morris on earth. I've seen, you know, Brass Eye, The Day Today.
Yes.
We'll talk about all this next time, I'm sure. The one thing of his I've never got round to seeing is Four Lions. So I'm so glad you've picked that, dude.
And it sits perfectly on my Blu-ray collection.
Next time, Four Lions. It's only time for Starmageddon, the greatest game show ever by Gemma. Because it is, because it's the only one you've ever done.
Yeah,
so by default, it's your best one. And also your worst one.
For anyone that hasn't listened to the last episode, I recommend you do because it's a very good game show. I'll give you credit when you deserve it, but I'll also knock you down when you deserve it. But fair play, Poochie. This was an unbelievable game. And it's basically, to sum it up, it's basically two of us one-on-one against each other with one of us being the game's master. We will go on sites like Amazon or IMDb and look for those really bad one-star ratings that people give to films. Basically, the public or reviewers, they give them really bad, stupid reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Then as the game's master, you'll read out this review to both players and it will be up to them to hopefully guess the film from the very bad one-star review.
It will be.
Now, if you'd listened on the last episode, I lost, which is annoying. So I really need you to win today, Gemma. Otherwise, Ben's automatically won.
Do my best.
No pressure. Hey, you didn't win the Lion game. That was. Remember that one where you had to be a bullshitter? I won that, surprisingly. But yeah, it's 1-0 to Ben at the moment. But today's episode, I will be the games master, so I won't lose today, which is a good start. And I'm kind of rooting for Gemma. But, you know.
Well, I don't like the idea of the supposedly impartial games master rooting for one of the other people. Thanks for that.
Yours will be really easy now.
This is bullshit.
So To make it fair, who would like to go first? Fastest hand. Oh, Gemma's really quick there. Are you ready for this?
Ready.
I'm going to try and do sort of voices as well, like sort of impressions.
Oh, that's,
sort of...
that's not going to end well.
Wait, I remember when we did the script read-through of The Room. So how's your day? Like, yeah. It wasn't American.
Okay, it won't be. I'll just be myself.
No, yeah. No. Oh, no, I feel bad.
No, please do try.
I made a huge mistake when renting this movie. It's meant to be a true classic. It doesn't fit my taste at all. What are you on about? I thought it would be about a spirit or a ghost, not some stupid space creature. The only space creature I care about is E.T.
Did you write this, Mark?
No.
Oh,
I haven't finished yet.
Okay.
Don't worry. It was boring. The special effects looked dreadful. But hey, as a dog lover, I was very happy with at least a couple of husky dogs.
That's great. Huskies. Is it The Thing?
Correct.
Yes!
I wouldn't have known it until you said the Huskies thing. That gave it away.
1-0.
Yes.
Good work.
Thank you.
I went to see this with my mates in the cinema, and when I came out, we all said, "This is awful." Basically, there's three funny parts in the whole film, and they were all in the trailer. Basically, the first half of the film is them just walking around looking for survivors. Then the second half of the film is them just sitting in a pub. Dreadful film. Boring, don't get the hype, unfunny, never seeing it again.
Shaun of the Dead.
Correct. Yeah. Gone easy there, haven't I?
That's a good one.
Are you ready for your next one?
Let's do this.
People consider this a master...
Sorry.
People consider this a masterpiece. Not me. This is completely style over substance. Laughable dialogue. Script makes no sense. Christian Bale. Dreadful. One of his worst, and to know this cost $250 million, no thank you. I'll stay away from this violent nonsense.
American Psycho?
No.
Oh,
right, okay, so I get to steal a point. It's either going to be, I'm going to put out my two choices before I say which one it's going to be. It's either going to be The Dark Knight or The Dark Knight Rises. I'm going to go Rises, Dark Knight Rises.
It's Dark Knight.
Shit the bed.
Why are you cheering?
Because
I didn't
losing,
get the point.
Yeah.
I know.
How many have we got each? I forget.
Three each.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I got this film because I love dogs. I got this film because I love dogs and I wanted a really good guilty pleasure cheesy film. It was cheesy, but not quite as enjoyable as I wanted. I was basically looking for a dog version of Mean Girls. Did I get it? No, I didn't. And I also find it slightly disturbing that the dog was actually fighting throughout, and this is meant to be a children's film.
So it's a film with a killer dog or a violent dog for kids.
There's dogs fighting in it. But they wanted Mean Girls for dogs.
Christ.
Because I love you, just think of Skip to the End. Just think of the history of us. That's all I'm going to say.
Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Yes.
God.
Amazing.
Are you ready?
Let's do this.
You got to get this right or else
I
win because I'm 2-1 up.
Felix.
I was really looking forward to seeing this really anticipated Oscar-winning film, but I was really disappointed. It was obvious all along what was going to happen, and everybody else seemed to miss it. Maybe if you didn't know what was going to happen, you would enjoy it, but I found it annoying. The clues were there, right in front of me. I won't be watching this again.
Can I just say, I love the fact that... Just keep doing this for the rest of your life, because you've got a career in this.
Thank you.
Oh, Oscar winner. The clues were there all along. So it's a film with a twist.
To give you a clue, because I like you,
yeah.
I don't actually think this actually won any Oscars. Mm. I think the person was just a bit of a moron.
No worries.
So come on then, Gemma, on the
okay.
spot.
Okay. I'm going to say The Sixth Sense.
Correct.
Yes!
That would have been my guess as well.
So, what's the scores?
It's 2 each.
2 each,
so
yeah.
But you've got an advantage.
I can either win it or it goes to the tiebreak.
Oh, man.
Just how anyone could think this is actually moving or inspiring is beyond me. I'm not going to slag it off because I can't see reasons why people would actually like it. But this is offensive, this film. It's morally corrupt. all this stuff about having the American dream and it still being alive, it's not going to be for a cripple in my eyes. If only they spent this much time and faith and stopped putting the message that Uncle Sam is always right, the world would be a better place.
Well, the use of the word cripple was shocking to me.
Wow. I know. It's not us.
Yeah.
But this person was angry about the American dream being given to a cripple.
Christ. I don't know. The People versus Larry Flint.
Forrest Gump.
Oh, Jesus.
So we're now in a tiebreaker.
Tiebreaker
situation. My throat hurts, actually, because of the voice. So I'm just going to have a spit of Strongbow Dark Fruit.
Is it refreshing?
So what happens with a tiebreaker is there's a very, very bad film that someone's given a 10 out of 10.
Absolutely.
It is really down to the fastest person now because it's shout out the right answer.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do this.
Okay.
Me and my sister used to watch this over and over and over again in the 80s. The story is so good. A young boy who's very different.
Mac and Me.
How did you know that?
Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
Ridiculous.
Can I finish, please?
Of course you can.
A young boy is different in every way, down to his wheelchair. But everyone knows that alien can help, even the people at the testing of time. What a great film. Well done, Gemma.
Well done, Gemma.
It's all to play for now on the next episode. What's going to happen, just so I can put it out there now, so on the next episode when I beat Gemma, we're all in one all.
Yeah.
Is it going to be rock, paper, scissor, or...
Ooh.
No, we're going to have a fist fight.
Okay. Stick around for that in 2 weeks' time. Almost at the end, but we've still got time for listener questions. Let's start with... Shimo the Intern, which is at Intern Shimo. Have you ever listened back to one of your podcasts and thought, I really wish I gave different answers to those questions?
All the time.
You've only been here 2 minutes.
Oh, no. But it's like today's episode, like after hearing your guys' opening scenes and as to why you've chosen them, and it's like, why couldn't I have watched that film instead? So yeah, it's when you listen to you two and... You know, you guys have such good and valid reasons why.
I do it all the time. We keep a list of all of our topic choices over on our fabulous website, skiptotheend.co.uk. If you go on there, you'll see everything we've ever picked. And I look back at that quite frequently and think, why did I pick that? Mm-hmm. You know, that's ridiculous. Like, I'm sure Mark still regrets picking the Sandman from Spider-Man 3 as being the supporting performance and outshone the lead, because it's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard.
What about?
And I think, Gemma, in maybe a month or two, you'll regret picking Groot as one of the worst serial killers in
film.
He
killed 5 men in a row!
And I do the same. And it's the reason why we do our top 5 choices every year, because it does change.
I kind of... It's weird. The longer this podcast goes on and the more our eyes are open to new films, especially like we've talked about today, I can't think why... Apocalypse Now wouldn't go straight in at my top 70s film. I know it's obviously been, but it's, I do joke about wanting to George Lucas stuff, but knowing that Ben left Blade Runner out of his best films of all time when we first did the podcast, and since you've seen Jaws, now surely Jaws would make one of your top 3 scary films of all time now, and there's so much that we've been given from this podcast that it does change everything, and it sounds crazy, but when we do our top 5 films again... Apocalypse Now, if I watch it again and the theatre cut and everything, that could now be a contender. And it's mind-blowing.
I think it'll hustle its way in my top 5 now. Mm-hmm.
So yes, Shimon, we definitely do. And even the listener questions, I sometimes listen back and go, I wish I had said this, or I wish I had said that.
Well, that's the thing, you know, with our topics and stuff, we get a week or two weeks to plan our answers. Listener questions, they're off the cuff, and we just say the first thing that comes into our head.
Oh, God, I think a few episodes have said Dat Boot for something. I was like, Jesus, Gemma.
That's not your worst. Trust me, Groot is one that's going to be brought up in your
review. He was a psycho.
You're a psycho for picking it. Felix has asked... He's recently watched Blair Witch, I think the new one he's referring to. I haven't seen it yet.
No.
He's asking, what are our favourite found footage films?
Oh, that's a great question. For me, it's Rec.
I agree with Rec. I absolutely love it. But I do like Cloverfield, and I never understand why people slag it off.
I love Cloverfield. Yeah. It's a great film.
Because most of the found footage films are horror films, which I don't watch, so I've not seen Rec or anything like that.
Yeah.
I have seen Cloverfield, and I love Cloverfield quite a bit, and I never understood why that wasn't given the props it deserves. So I'll go with Cloverfield as well.
It's a great
film. Good one that people should check out is Troll Hunter.
Yes,
that's
oh
been
God,
on my
yes.
list for so long.
It's a great film.
It's a good film.
I think,
but,
I think it might still be on Netflix. I need to check that out.
Yeah, and for any horror buffs out there as well, it's not the greatest of film, but it's a heck of a lot of fun. Check out VHS and VHS 2 as well. It's just a collection of short horror stories. It's never going to win any awards, but it is a heck of a lot of fun.
VHS scared me. The girl, real skinny girl with the black hair, scared the hell out of me.
Or what about the girl that morphs into like this flying demon?
Absolutely
wing
horrible.
Beast? Terrifying.
Terrifying. Mm. Scott Jameson has said, guys, who would win a Battle of the Beards?
Me.
Right? Out of Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson, or George Lucas?
Jacko.
That's a tough one, isn't it? When I picture them, all I picture is... I don't really picture Steven Spielberg as a big bearded guy.
No.
Peter Jackson, for me, has got a good beard, and he's been to like Mordor and stuff.
Yeah, so he's
lived through conditions that are... more than green screen studios for George.
He's like a grubby Santa Claus.
But that said, he often goes beardless. You know, you'll see him sometimes with a beard, sometimes without. Whereas George Lucas, ever since the 70s, has had the exact same beard. And it's a beard that doesn't go far enough down his chin. It stopped, honestly, you'd have seen it in the Hearts of Darkness documentary. Yeah. It stops at his jawline, so you can still see his toad-like double chin hanging out beneath it. It needs to grow the motherfucker down to cover that flab.
Yeah, it's the worst... neck ever.
He also has like the coiffed fringe as well.
Hey, leave his hair alone, all right? What? I'm talking beards.
No, it just melts into it. It's like a face fuzz.
Andy Sarks has said, Ben mentioned on a previous episode that you annually watch Blade Runner.
At least I watch it once a year.
I was wondering what films you all have to watch annually. Is there, not just because of Halloween, but is there... You know, I think we've all said that we watch Die Hard and Gremlins at Christmas and stuff like that.
I watch Die Hard every year, absolutely, yeah.
For me, The Usual Suspects and Seven.
Yeah?
Because they're just so dark. It is a film that you don't really need to watch like every month or every few months. That is a once-a-year film, and it's just glorious throughout.
I have said it on many podcasts. I always watch Big. Mm-hmm. That's probably two or three times a year. But I know Ben's going to go, ugh. But I love Clerks and I love Chasing Amy. And I'll make sure that every year I watch it. It's just like a thing. It doesn't have to be like, oh, it's July, I'll watch it. But I'll always make sure that if I know it's been so long, it's going on. Kieran Leeson has asked, if you could be best friends with any movie character in the world, best friends, who would you choose? Now, I've just put that on the spot for you. So I'm going to tell you who I'm going to go for. And that gives you a bit of thinking time. I've chosen two. One would be Quint, because I'd love to get drunk with him and I just would love to hear his stories. He's only given us one good story and it was a great one. So imagine what else he's got to tell us. Not just about his scars, but his ex-girlfriends and his old drinking buddies. And he's probably got kids we don't know about.
Yeah.
But I would love to be best friends with Garth Elgar. He would be such a good guy to hang out with. More than Wayne. He's got your back and he's just cool. And I love Red Rope Licorice.
I've got two. I think for someone that I'd want to go out drinking with, I'd want to be best friends with Nick Frost's character from Shaun of the Dead.
Nice.
Just go down the Winchester with him. And just because he's got a lot of cash, I'd go with Michael Douglas's character, Gordon Gekko from Wall Street.
Oh, nice.
I'd hope that he's generous to his friends.
For me, the ultimate best mate would be Apple from Turbo Kid, because she's loyal and she's dedicated and she'll do all she can to help in any way, shape or possible. So Apple would be my bezzy.
But she needs maintenance. She's not real. You'd have to be I haven't charged her today.
But she is real. What are you saying?
Phil Hand has asked, there's a lot of TV now coming from films, hell of a lot. Lethal Weapon, The Omen, he's just seen the first episode of The Exorcist. He's saying, is it a bit overkill? Do you believe they actually work?
Well, it comes back to exactly what I was saying in the opening about intellectual property. It's the reason why Lethal Weapon has been made into a series, because they have this existing IP of a film series that was wildly successful. So they go, okay, we will use name recognition to make a TV show of it. And sometimes they succeed, and often they fall flat on their arses. I was reading a review the other day of a reboot of MacGyver. I know that's not come from a film, that's come from another version of the TV series. And they're saying it's terrible because it's forgotten all the things that MacGyver stood for in the original. Again, I read a review of the Lethal Weapon one, and people said... it's fine, but because it's a TV show, it doesn't have the kind of R-rated violence and humour that the films did, so it just pales in comparison.
Yeah, I think it's another way of exploring that particular world. On the last episode on the review, we said that the ending of Hell or High Water would be great to continue as a television show, and I think we've seen that with the first two seasons of Fargo as well.
Yeah,
I think there's definitely some viability in exploring a different part of it rather than the main focus of what it was seen in a film. So for that, I do think it's a good thing, but you do have to pick very, very carefully and explore it in a way that perhaps wasn't seen in cinema, such as Fargo.
I think that's absolutely key. If they would have tried to remake the Fargo film as a series, wouldn't have worked.
No.
Wouldn't have worked at all.
Nope.
But the fact that they did this thing that was set in the same universe, essentially,
so it's
brilliant. Both seasons of Fargo are impeccable.
They are.
And the best example for that working for me, Hannibal.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I'm going to say it now. I think we're all going to be absolutely jizzing over Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
Westworld looks great. The trailers look unreal.
My God. Mm-hmm. We'll just say it now. We're in the cinema tonight, and that was the first trailer I've ever seen. This is not a film. And then they did the Sky Atlantic trailer for it. And I was just like, oh,
it looked
man.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Talking about Westworld,
yes.
Anything you want to say about Westworld?
I watched it for the very first time the
other
night.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. I love how it's made out to be like this, especially at the beginning where it's like a sort of a cheesy travel agent kind of advertisement for people to go and see it. Because I think initially I didn't think of it being that way. I just thought it was a Western film set in the 1800s with robots in it.
Yeah.
But I love the way how they did it. I thought it was incredibly clever. And it's certainly a film that I'd recommend as well.
Mm-hmm.
At Angie773, this will be the quickest answer to any question we've ever had. Batman or Superman?
Batman.
Done.
Couple more questions. Lord Cutter on Twitter has said, this is a big one, where do you all see Skip to the End in 5 years' time? Not even a year. 5 years.
Well, hopefully past my probation period.
We shall see. Hold on. We'll find out next week. Getting cocky.
I think I'll be dead in 5 years.
Hopefully. We are essentially
Christ.
2 years on from the start. We are essentially where we were. We've just got better equipment. So, I don't know, maybe the good people at Shaw will hook us up with some really sweet mics between now and 5 years.
I think it's got to the point now the listeners wouldn't hear that much difference.
We would, though, because we're so anal about it.
I think that eventually Strongbow will hear all these plugs we've given them, send us absolutely loads to say thank you, and we'll all drink ourselves to death.
Sounds good. So that's how you'll be dead.
Yes. Hopefully. That's brutal, man. And to finish things off, and this is quite fitting with what you've just said.
Oh, come on.
At Quani Gliam, which is Gliam, will Gemma get past her probation?
We don't know yet.
And I hope so.
Actually something that we wanted to talk about.
Oh, my God.
So on the next episode, this is serious, me and Ben are going to be sitting down and going through a review. The giggling's not helping me
at all.
Anyway.
It's good job I've got my clipboard in front of me, because that's a big cross.
So we're actually, for the listeners out there, all of you, we'll be doing a live probation review on the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
So keep the listener questions coming for me and Ben.
Yeah.
And maybe Gemma, and all will be revealed in 2 weeks' time.
And all I'm going to say is, between now and the next recording, she's buggering off on a holiday that she did not approve through HR. So might affect the overall outcome.
To Canada, of all places. It's not like you can come back and finish the recording and then go back.
Yeah.
Selfish. Send help.
And that brings us to the end of yet another Skip to the End podcast. 55 done. 5 for Gemma. Done.
Maybe.
No, well, they've actually been done.
Oh, no,
this isn't a dream.
Will it get past that, though?
Well, you've definitely got one more, because then that brings you to the end of your 3-month probation.
Unless whether
you
plane
get to
crashes.
Whether you get to a 7. Well, that's an awful thing to say.
You said that you wish I was... what did you say? I'll be dead, hopefully. But yeah, it's fine for me not to, you know.
Well, you were very specific about her plane crashing. She's going on a plane next week. That's horrible.
The worst part is, if it actually happened, I hope it doesn't, but people would be like, he knew, he plotted this. Yeah. Listen, and evidence will be on iTunes and Podomatic and Stitcher. I don't wish you death.
Thanks.
We wish you nothing but a safe journey.
Aww.
Get back in time to record, basically.
In time for the probation.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, next episode, what have we got on?
We've got a hell of a lot on. It is your pick of topic, Gemma. What are we doing?
It is. We're going to look at the top 3 teen movies.
We are indeed, which is quite a broad spectrum. But I've already got a few percolating in my mind. I'm
this
looking forward
good.
To
As long as they're between 13 and 19, we should be good.
I like how you've very clearly specified the age. But yeah, you're right. That is the teenage. Yeah, yeah. That's absolutely fine.
I've got a worried look then. I thought some teenager was a 16.
Mark had what was known as a Gary Glitter look in his eyes. Mark, what are we rewatching?
We are rewatching a... I want to say... No, it's not a classic. That's unfair to say. We're just going to be watching Four Lions.
Yeah. Mm.
There we go. And I'm very looking forward to knowing what you think as you're going in dry.
Indeed I am, and I've been meaning to watch it for so long, so I'm really, really excited about watching that. We'll be giving away prizes, we normally do. We're also going to be doing the next round of Movie Masturbate. It's our first woman that we're going to be masturbating over. I purposely spaced it out there. I didn't want to sound crude like yourself,
There was
Mark.
A lot of spaces there.
Thank you. We're going to be wanking over, masturbating over Winona Ryder, which is going to be great because yes. Winona, you know, she's back in business at the minute. She's been in Stranger Things. People are loving Winona again. Mm. So I'm looking forward to that. And we will also be playing the final round of Starmageddon, where I am the games master.
When you just said Stranger Things then, it made me realise you just said, oh, we'll be giving some stuff away. We're giving away a one-off Stranger Things inspired t-shirt.
So we
like,
are,
you're making it, it's, oh, just giving stuff away. We're giving away a one-off.
That's pretty cool.
And the Kubo wasn't a one-off, as we proved. Yeah. So it's not going to be like, if you drop me any emails this week, any listeners telling me that you've always inspired to be a t-shirt printer, you're not getting one.
No. I like how you just pointed out that we lie then, because we said that that thing was a one-off and it turns out it's not. So none of this could be true. It might be absolute bollocks. So tune in 2 weeks' time. This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend.